Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today at Freedomizer Radio. Up next is Brother Gregory with Keys of the Kingdom, and after that, Be the Power in You. Our special guest today, Kurt John Forty from Prophet Organic. So stay tuned.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk about the Kingdom of God. And I'm getting all my buttons pushed here so that I know what I'm doing. But anyway, the topic this morning was going to be Hebrews as we continue in chapter 7, I think it was, that we were working in, and it shifted over to the concept of repent, which I talk about all the time, and of course that's where most of the Gospels began, with this idea of John the Baptist, Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ telling the apostles to, you know, repent and to seek this kingdom of God, which is at hand, and seek the righteousness of God. And so we went through a lot of different parts of the Bible, and we went through Peter, 2 Peter chapter 2, and it talks about people coming in as ministers and deceiving you. And, you know, it's the old wolves in sheep's clothing kind of things. And, you know, they talk about damnable heresies and everybody getting deceived and being fooled and brought into bondage. He's using these words that you're going to become merchandise and brought into bondage. And it sounds pretty bad. And the pig is going to return to his mire and the dog is going to return to his vomit. And everybody's going to be entangled again in the elements of the world. And, you know, nobody seems to quite get what that's all about because they don't understand what the early church was really doing and what was going on in history at that particular time. And so in these other shows, we were talking about that, what was going on in history and what was being done at that time in the world. And the world was the system of government that we know as the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was originally a republic about 500 years before. Actually, it goes back even 700 years. There was evidently some sort of massive flood at one time that came ashore and just devastated the Romans. And they moved their city inland into this area that is known today as the Seven Hills, which is where we find Rome. And they rebuilt. And The flood may actually, or this shifting where, you know, water come in from sea, some sort of tidal wave and everything. Geologists have gone back and tried to figure out what period of time was this and what was actually going on. But they moved it back to this area of Seven Hills, and they built a new civilization. They began this rebuilding partially with a period of time that was revolutionary. There were people who were in charge at that time, and they were called the Tarquinian Kings, and they had a system of government, and the people found it oppressive, and the people got together and threw off the Tarquinian Kings. Now, whenever you take down a governmental system in history, you have to have something to replace it. And many countries have done this, where they've overthrown some dictator or ruler or regime. And when they overthrew that regime, they replaced it with a new regime. that was worse than the first regime. You know, it's kind of like they threw out the kings of France, you know, chopped off the head of Louis and Marie Antoinette, and then, which was immediately followed by a dictatorial bloodbath that caused the death of thousands and tens of thousands of Frenchmen, and got them involved in one war after another where thousands and thousands more died. And it devastated society. And, of course, after that devastation, you know, people began to start rebuilding and everything. But it wasn't the wars. It wasn't the new government. It wasn't the revolution that saved them. The American Revolution was notoriously bloodless, just amazingly bloodless. Now, many people died in it. Many people suffered, mostly from the elements. Lewis's or Clark's march across the frontier, and he took fort after fort. That was taking most of those forts without killing any of the enemy. They would shoot at the fort, and they would keep them pinned down for a period of time. And eventually, they realized it was better to surrender than to be pinned up in the fort, and they surrendered. But they took great pains not to kill anybody. Fort Ticonderoga, taking it. Nobody was killed. You can't say it was a bloodless revolution because there were battles, Bunker Hill, and many people died. And the English, the British, and the Hessians, they were certainly trying to kill us. And at times we were killing them. And we kind of had this tendency to pick on the officers. And not pick on the enlisted men. Many of the Hessians who were fighting us during the American Revolution actually stayed. They never, when their enlistment was up, they didn't go back. They actually stayed in America and proved up land. They kind of liked the ideas that were going around back then. One of the problems, though, is today, most Americans are unaware of what was going on back then. They don't understand what this whole thing was about of settling America. They have the idea that people were coming here for free land. No, they were coming here for land that was free, not free to buy. And it cost them their lives. It cost them a fortune to prove up land. You had to clear trees and plow it, and it took oxen and equipment. And so it was expensive, and you were a long ways away from trading places, so markets had to be opened up. But yet people came and proved up land because they actually wanted to own the land themselves. You see, you could get land in England, you could get land in Europe, but you couldn't own the land. You would have to pay a tax on the land. And whenever you have to pay a tax on the land, that's because you don't really own the land. You own like a legal title. And if you own a legal title, you don't own the beneficial interest, because the beneficial interest is not included in a legal title. That's the law. Now, you probably don't know that either, because they're not teaching you that in the school. You can actually look it up in Black's Law Dictionary, and we quote it in the book Covenants of the Gods in the chapter on law versus legal, and explain all this out, that you don't actually own the land, that you're actually tenants upon the land. You don't own your labor anymore. We also explain that in the book Covenants of the Gods. You're actually back into the bondage of Egypt. See, because the dog has returned to his vomit and the pig to his mire. You have again been entangled in the elements of the world, and you've gone back into bondage. Now, for the last 100 years or so, they've been telling you, no, you're free. This is the freest country in the world. And in the last 50 years, they've been telling you that it's a democracy. And, of course, it really isn't a democracy. It's a republic. And that's what it was originally. But in the republic, there is a thing called democracy. And that's what you're a part of. And you're back in this bondage again of the world. And you're entangled again in the elements of the world, just like the Bible is talking about. And you are surety for debt, which the Bible warns you over and over again not to be surety for debt. And yet, there you are, being a surety for debt. And you don't own your labor, you don't own your land, you don't own your children. And all this is the absolute antithesis of one of the great motivators for many people to come to America. And the reason they were motivated to do this is because they had been reading and translating the Bible, and they were beginning to realize what liberty was and what freedom was. And coming here to America, they really had to take a crash course in this. When they first came here, they actually tried to create kind of socialist states in the Pilgrims did this, Jamestown did this, and, you know, from each according to his ability and to each according to his needs. And people were starving. Every year the people starved under that rule. The year they decided, no, you grow it, you produce it, it's yours. Nobody has a right to take any of it away. Capitalism, the private ownership of property. You would actually, and the interesting thing is people like the Pilgrims were actually coming here to own land in fee simple. They actually wanted to own the allodial title of land, and they had I'm actually writing a book on this subject, and I have another one I have to finish before I finish that one. But they were going through great, and you talk about your conspiracies, there was all kinds of things going on behind the scenes, not necessarily honest stuff that the Pilgrims were doing, in order to attain land that would not be under the authority of the crown. And they had a very devious, complex plan in order to do this. And it was amazing, the courage of the people. And, of course, half the Pilgrims were dead the first year they came. And so there was a great sacrifice. This cost them dearly. And thousands of people would die over the years to come in this struggle to settle the wilderness. It just was not working out, settling this wilderness. And yet people kept coming. And kept coming and kept coming. And their motivation was this hope of owning land. And the Pilgrims eventually paid off the land and all their debts that they had. And that was actually kind of some ceremony to the whole event. And they paid it off with real money. And they owned the land. Now, they had turned down six contracts. They finally accepted the seventh contract with the company that they were supposedly doing business with to come here, and they were actually secretly doing business with their competition, but then that didn't work out. But we'll finish that story when I finish the book. But the point was that they eventually did own land where they owned it. They actually owned the beneficial interest of land. It could not be taxed by anybody. And there was a large number of people in America that could own land, and it could not be taxed by the government or anybody else because they actually owned the land. And this, according to the Oxford Dictionary, makes them freemen. They were trying to be freemen. And like I say, many men and women and their children died trying to get to the point where they would actually own land, because the definition of a freeman requires that you actually own the beneficial interest of land. It did back then. It did 100 years before that. It did 1,000 years before that. And it did it 2,000 years before that. It did it back in the days of Rome. They needed to own land as individual families, and that land could be passed down from family to family. No inheritance tax, no property tax, no tax on your labor, none of that. And that's what they threw out the Tarquinian kings in order to obtain. And that's partially why they moved their city, their community. I mean, their city back in those early days was pretty primitive, pretty rustic. And it wasn't the big marble halls that they would eventually build. But they began a new process with a new kind of government, and different than the form of government that they had under the Tarquinian kings. And they discovered what the secret of success was. And the more successful they got, the more they forgot what made them successful. They lost memory, conscious memory, of what made them a great nation. And they became less than great, and began to become corrupt and fall apart. Now, understanding exactly the process of this in history is very important because history does repeat itself. They formed a republic. They didn't call it a republic at first. They made reference to it with an actual phrase, which in the Latin language is known as an idiom. And it used to be a common phrase. A lot of people knew about it. And it's almost completely disappeared from our vocabulary. I don't know that it's a conspiracy or anything, but it just disappeared. And the phrase was libera res publica. Libera res publica. Now, I still find it in documents on the European continent. And if you search it out on the internet, you'll probably find our website mentioning it. But it's the original idiom from which we get the word republic. And it's very interesting what a republic is. And now, those of you who are regular listeners know that we've talked about words like religion and faith and how they meant one thing 200 years ago. Somebody changed the definition and it became meaning something else 100 years ago. And then now it means something completely different than what it meant 200 years ago when the Constitution was written. It also means something completely different than it meant back in the days of Jesus Christ, when they translated a particular Greek word, threskia, into religion. That's what we translate into religion. And threskia actually means what you do. And at different times, it meant specific things that you do. And the Romans were doing them 500 years before Christ. And we would call their religion pagan religion because we think they have a different opinion about who God was than we do, because we think that religion is what you think about the Creator. You know, how you conjure up your image, draw your picture of the Creator, and that's religion. What the Creator that you draw and what you believe in, that's religion. But that's not what the definition used to be. It used to be how you fulfilled your duty, how you performed your duty, how you took on the responsibilities to God and your fellow man. That's what religion used to be. What you did told us what your religion was. It wasn't, you know, the cut of your hair or the clothes that you wear or the crucifix around your neck or you know, where you went to church on Sunday or Sabbath. That didn't tell you what your religion was. What told us what your religion was what you did in relationship to fulfilling your duty to God and your fellow man. Now, an interesting thing is there were other cultures around at that same time that had this same idea, both at the time of Christ and 500 years before, at the time of Rome's beginning as a republic. And they knew that in order to bind their society together, they had two choices. They could elect another king, another Tarquinian king, who would exercise authority, and he would go out and collect taxes, and all the land of their nation would be under his authority, and he would take a portion of your crops or a portion of your labor and a portion of your property, and he would use it for himself and the fulfillment of his duty, which would be to take care of the social welfare and protection. It usually starts with protection of their society. This is how Saul got elected. Saul was elected because they wanted a king like the other governments all around them. Now, Saul was getting elected long before the Roman Empire was beginning to become set up. So you would have to imagine that the people in Rome knew about Israel and how it operated before they set up their republic, when they were throwing out the Tarquinian kings. Those Romans, those ones we call Romans, those Etruscans, they knew about Israel. They knew how it worked. They knew, actually, they probably had a better picture of how it worked than most of the people do today. Certainly, a lot of the people at the time of Christ, because the Pharisees had it all wrong. They'd completely screwed it up. They had cloaked it in all kinds of religious mumbo-jumbo and blood sacrifices and fancy robes you know, and golden temples and palaces, and had completely strayed from the precepts and pearls of wisdom that had established the kingdom of God amongst those sons who came out of Egypt with Moses. They had changed it all, and they didn't know what God really wanted them to do. And so when Christ came along and started telling them, they didn't recognize Christ as knowing the Holy Scriptures, as knowing the purposes of God, the doctrines of the prophets. Instead, they wanted to kill him. They wanted to, you know, put him down and mock him and all these kinds of things. They just, you know, some of them probably didn't want him killed, but they just don't want him out there causing trouble, because we got this cool thing where people go to church and they tithe to us, and the government has to take care of their needs, and they're all signed up for a system of Corban, which means sacrifice, that takes care of all our social welfare. And the priests of the temples, who used to be the poor preachers who actually took care of the needs of the people, were now wealthy, wealthy even beyond the king. And the same kinds of things were happening over in Rome, actually even earlier than Rome. But let's go back in history, back before the first king of Israel, which was Saul. And it says there were no kings in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And people always say, and that was a mess. Well, actually, we don't know a lot about that whole period of time. We know about the problems that came up, but that's because the bad news always gets the press. Most of the time, they weren't having trouble. As a matter of fact, most of the time, nobody could even come near them. They were invincible. They were doing really good, and they were really prosperous. They didn't build big, huge temples and things with columns and all that kind of stuff and stone walls and big city streets, but they were invincible as a people. They were strong. They were healthy. There were no cultures healthier than early Israel. The people, the stature and strength and character of the people was just absolutely amazing. But they also allowed strangers in the midst, and it brought in goofy ideas, and these ideas would contaminate the community, and they would get farther and farther away. And you could see different things that happened during this period where they got farther and farther away from what you might call righteous. So that some of the cities, especially cities, now the countryside was much different, but in the cities where people gathered and everything and this commerce was going on, you would start to see this corruption of society raising up its head. It was still a pretty good place, but they got to a point where they became slothful in the ways of liberty, in the ways of the prophets, in the ways of men like Abraham, Moses, and John the Baptist, and Jesus Christ. And they said, let's have a king. Now, they had judges that were corrupt, and then you have to understand how those judges were elected, because the courts were from bottom up. But they had these judges that became corrupt, and they were letting people off the hook when they should have been, you know, held accountable for the evil that they did. And there's a way they do this, and they corrupt the priesthood. And how do they corrupt the priesthood? People begin to put the priesthood on a pedestal. They begin to turn too much over to them. And before you know it, some of them start getting bribes, and you don't want to alienate them. You don't want to say anything that might make them mad and go away, and so you start compromising character. Done all the time in churches today. Can't afford that. You got to speak the truth. This is what it means by seeking righteousness. Doesn't matter if a man's rich. Doesn't matter if a man's powerful. If he does wrong, you have to hold them to account. Doesn't matter if he's Billy Graham or Joel Osteen or let's think of some other people that aren't religious figures, you know, some political figure. If he's doing wrong, you got to call him on it. If he's doing wrong with his family, you got to call him on it. you know. But we don't do that anymore. It was a time when if there was any kind of a marriage scandal in the White House, that guy was toast. He wasn't going to be around. Nowadays, you can have all kinds of promiscuity, and everybody says, well, they even do this with their preachers. Preachers are caught doing terrible things, and they say, oh, well, he's only human. We have to forgive him. And they let him be their preacher. He can't be their preacher anymore. But anyway, let's go back to Rome. Let's take a look at Rome. What were they doing? They had to make a drastic change in the form of government from a kingdom, Tarquinian kings, and become this republic. So now they're replacing one government form with another government form. And the new government form is supposed to allow more freedom. How's this going to work? Well, fortunately, they had a number of disasters at that time. And, of course, then they had a civil war. And things were just a mess. And they moved to another place and started all over again. And all these things, over a period of time, began to change the way in which people looked at government. And they had a thing called hearths. And these were families and groups of families that would get together, small groups, and they would pick a minister, and that minister would tend to their needs as a small group, as a congregation, if you want. We use the word congregation in the old Hebrew, a synagogue, and they had similar words in the Latin, assembly, meaning assemblies of small family groups. But a small family group was a victim very quickly if a large group came in to rob and steal. So they had to have a way of connecting all these families, hundreds of families, over a pretty wide, extensive area. And so they picked, every 10 families would pick a minister. And that minister would get together with other 9 ministers like himself, and they would pick a minister. And this created this kind of daisy chain network that allowed that if there was a problem in one area of the country, if there were Gauls coming down or Jutes coming down and invading, they would have this network of communications, network of aid, network of assistance, and like I say, information that would help bring a whole nation of people together. Now, why would you deal with that? Why would you keep those lines of communication open in times of peace? Well, even in times of peace, there are problems. Sometimes there's a thief in the area, and he's going to move to another area. And if you have this communication, you know, hey, this guy was the guy that was over in our area when all that stealing was going on. Or, you know, whatever it is. This guy's a con man. This guy's a liar. This guy's, you know, he's actually fronting for his buddies, and they're going to come and steal from you, and then they'll take all the stuff they steal, and they'll go to another place. And he's going around scouting for them because he did the same thing in our community. See, or maybe it's disease. Maybe it's a blight in your fruit trees or your orchards. And this is your health, educational, welfare guys. These guys, ministers, that's what they're doing. They're not just, you know, blowing smoke and talking beautiful thoughts about God and shaking rattles and beads and saying mumbo-jumbo prayers and, blowing smoke, burning incense. They actually provided a service to the community, and the community saw that they were of value. Same thing going on way up in what we call Germany today. Same thing going on way up in areas of Gaul, going all the way up into the Scandinavian nations. This is how people gather together. Now, they do it with lesser or greater elements of ability and to different degrees. And this often determined the success of society. But now, when we come back, the Keys of the Kingdom, we're going to talk about how this translates into the success of Rome and how they forgot about it. And it translated into the destruction of Rome. And then we'll talk about it in relationship to America and many other countries around the world and how they collapsed and began to become corrupted. Their foundations decayed and they fell too, although they haven't completely fallen, all but hit the sidewalk. But anyway, we'll do that when we come back to Keys to the Kingdom, right after these words from local sponsors.
Okay, well, thank you all for tuning in.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal, but something seems to be missing. Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com. But wait, there's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Come listen to Ancient of Days, where we talk about the lies, misrepresentations, and holes in the history we learned in school. Mondays, 3 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Freedomizer. Thank you.
Hi, this is Cindy Lake. Please listen to me on Freedom Talk with Cindy Lake at 5 o'clock Pacific Standard Time, 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on FreedomizerRadio.com. All the issues that are important to you, like Common Core, Agenda 21, Fully Informed Jury Association, 10th Amendment, 2nd Amendment, 4th Amendment, 3rd Amendment, the Constitution. See you at FreedomizerRadio.com, 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. See you there.
Hey there, Freedomizers. This is JC from the Sports Lounge. Join us for 3 hours on Saturdays as we take a break from politics to discuss sports at FreedomizerRadio.com. Come and join us each Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon Pacific, noon to 3 p.m. Eastern.
Silverleaf Tea and SodaStream are two sponsors here at Freedomizer Radio. We're working on getting those affiliate links back up on our website. In the meantime, you order those products, please let them know that you have that you received that information from Freedomizer Radio.
Hi, Freedomizers. I'm Lily Gonzalez, announcing my new show, Roaring for Healthcare with Tiger Lily. I was a registered nurse for many years, caring for patients from birth to death in 36 facilities across the nation, and I know firsthand just how utterly broken our healthcare system is. But now I'm free from nursing, so I'm able and thrilled to give you some juicy behind-the-scenes insights and advice to help you and your loved ones get the most from our healthcare system. Join me Monday through Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time to roar about healthcare only on Freedomizer Radio.
Excellent, excellent. Well, thank you all for joining us today, and we're back with Brother Gregory.
Well, welcome back to Keep the Kingdom. And we're talking about this whole Roman history thing where they became a republic. And, of course, if you ask a lot of people today about America, they'll say America's a republic, and they'll say that America's a democracy. And the fact is, the idea of a democracy and a republic are really at different ends of the spectrum. They are completely different. I mean, if you go back, look at the early American forefathers, they're saying a democracy is a bad thing, almost to the letter. They're all talking about democracy at one time or another as a bad thing. It wasn't until just in the last 50 years, 60 years, that democracy became a good thing. and everybody talks about the United States being a democracy. And in truth, the United States always was a democracy. That's right. It always was a democracy. Now, I know I get a lot of arguments here, but you got to bear me out here now. It says in the Constitution that it was going to guarantee a Republican form of government. It didn't say it was a Republican form of government. It said it would guarantee a Republican form of government. It's a corporate form of government. It has its bylaws, its constitution, and it was as foreign to the individual states almost as the states were as foreign to each other. And they state right in Clark's Summary of U.S. American Law that the states, even after the Constitution was put into place, were as foreign to each other as Mexico is to Canada. You were citizens of the individual states, which were republics to one degree or another. They weren't all pure republics. But a republic, the purity of a republic, depends upon the status of the individual citizen living on his own land in fee simple, untaxed by the government. And so you say, whoa, wait a minute, the government can't tax you? Can't tax you on your labor because you own it. Can't tax you on your land because you own it. You can't tax you on your children. Can't take your children from you because they belong to you. But that's not what you see anymore in America. You see another animal altogether, and that's what they talk about. If you go to that second Peter, chapter 2, they start right off talking about false teachers and damnable heresies, denying that the Lord is the Lord, meaning the government. And they talk about them bringing in pernicious ways. And through what do they use? Feigned words to make you merchandise, human resources, collateral for debt, surety for debt, covetousness. They get you to want your neighbor's stuff. You want your neighbor to pay for what you want. This is the pernicious ways. And it goes in all the way down into verse 12, and he starts talking about natural brute beasts, that our nature thinks that's okay. We've been taught that's okay, and this is what's changed. And it changed in Rome, too, because, see, Rome, when they first started, they started building. They had to build again. Everything was new. And they got good at building, and they built, and people came up with new ideas. Why? Because they had this government that was a network. You'll see this on different radio stations, different groups. They form networks, and they, you know, the Internet is a great example because it's being used to deceive people, but it's also, there's this underlying thing in the Internet where new information is going around. And they're throwing huge amounts of, hey, it's a great distraction on top of this. And you have to filter through and find the good stuff. And what they were doing, because they had a system bound together where these 10 families loved each other, they depended on each other, they helped each other, they picked a minister, and he connected them with other 10 families. So they did this all across the country. So that if a family way on the other side of the Seven Hills was attacked, everybody would come to their aid. Why? Because they knew that they needed them to come to their aid if they were attacked. And so they go to theirs and hope that they come back to theirs. In other words, they give through faith, hope, and charity. They keep these avenues open, and they became more and more successful. Everybody learned better ways of farming. If one guy came up with an idea and then they shared that with their minister, he shared it with 10 other ministers, and they shared it with 100 other ministers, and it got all around, and everybody was learning constantly, innovatively, becoming better builders, better miners, better at agriculture. Romans were good at taking information from anybody around them and turning it into value, and they became more and more successful. Working and earning your way, staying out of debt, was really important to the Romans. That's Sabbath. They understood that. So how did they do these big projects? Somebody discovers that there's gold up in where Spain is today, España, and they want to go up there and mine it. because they know a lot of good mining techniques because they have been in, everything's been improving because there's a network. Everybody's been sharing. It's kind of like the Wikipedia principle. You know, everybody just does their share because they want to help each other. And all the people who want to help each other come together and they build something. They make it happen. So now they want to go way across country, miles and miles away from their homes, and mine where they found this gold. So they invest money. They take real capital, gold that they already have, silver that they already have. Or they promise that they'll work. I'll go with you for 2 years up to this area, and I'll work. I'll help you build this, help you protect this. And they have the tens, hundreds, and thousands already, so they have their captains and their lieutenants. So they just gather together, and, you know, they get a couple of young men from this family and a couple of young men from that family, and you know, some have to stay back and do the work and protect the community. But they all go up, so every family's investing something, money, resources, everything, and they do this through what we ended up calling temples, like the Temple of Janus and Temple of Saturn. And these weren't buildings originally. This was an area. This is where their altars were. And they went there, and everybody invested in this with real capital, sometimes with time and effort as well. They do that on board ships and stuff like that still to this day. Anyway, they invested, and they went up, and they mined this mountain in northern Spain. And they dammed up rivers and made lakes. And they got local help to help them. And they paid them. And they all carried swords. These are your centurions. Because they were both soldiers and builders. They were actually builders and on the side soldiers. You were more likely to build something as a centurion than you were to pull your sword in battle throughout the history of Rome. That's the way it was for a long time. Towards the end, it was a little bit different. But so they're going out, and they build these lakes, and they build these runways, and they dig these canals, and they start making mines into the mountain, and they just dig these small holes, but then they divert the water into the holes and start washing the, and they literally removed the whole mountain. And they came away with tons of gold. Tons of gold. And it came back and everybody divided up shares and everybody was rich. And they did this time and time again. They did it with harbors. They did it with routes to trade routes. They are always figuring new ways to make a success, build. They built roads that are still in use. They built lead lined whole lakes to create hot baths, and they built 3-4 story aqueducts out of poured concrete still here. Just amazing what they did. And they were able to do this because they started with the tens, hundreds, and thousands based on voluntarily helping one another. When they created anything like hospitals or buildings or anything, it was all free will offerings, free will offerings. They didn't tax the people. They couldn't tax the people, and they didn't tax the people for a real long time. But then they began to centralize. Even the Senate had no power to tax the people. It was just called the Gathering of Old Men. They were a council. They couldn't pass new laws. The laws already existed. They already had their system of courts, which was the tens, hundreds, just like ancient Israel. They had all that in existence. But then they began to forget about it because they had built these palaces and these successes and brought in all kinds of other people that were working for them, and we call them slaves. They weren't really slaves. They were employees, and they had laws protecting them, and then they had to give them more and more rights because the people weren't doing the work. They were having other people do the work. And now that nobility took a long time to die out in Rome. And there were many of those noble people around in our series on the Romans. The Epistle of the Romans point out that there were these Romans who heard the gospel and said, that's what we used to do. That's what we used to do in Rome before we became this imperial dictatorship. And they wanted to get back to that. And some of those people want to get back to that happened to be nephews and half-brothers to guys like Paul, the apostle. And Paul was beginning to realize, oh, I've been listening to the Pharisees and this false religion and all this mumbo jumbo. And my nation has now gone into bondage. The dog has returned to his vomit and the pig to his mire. And he says, and all of a sudden he realizes Christ does have the answer. Took some spiritual intervention to knock him off his high horse. And I think it will take that with a lot of people today. They think they believe. They don't believe. They don't even know what was going on. Christ was teaching this same system. And Christians started doing it. Rome was still there. Judea was still there. Now, Jesus was declared king of the Jews by Rome. And so the church was actually operating the government of the people, for the people, and by the people, based on not taxation, but tithing, free will offerings, to take care of all the social welfare needs of the people through faith, hope, and charity, and the perfect law of liberty. This is what they were doing. They wouldn't take the benefits from the temples that had grown up. Now, the original temples, remember, operated by faith, hope, and charity. The original temples before Herod, and even way back with Saul, originally operated by faith, hope, and charity. Who forced the first contribution, forced the first sacrifice, forced the first tax on the people in Israel? Do you know when that was? That was Saul. He forced an offering. It says that. He forced an offering. He needed money to supply the army, and he was afraid that they might attack before he was ready, and so he forced an offering. That's what it says. Forced a sacrifice. Offering, sacrifice, same thing. And Samuel came in and said that he had done this wicked thing, and because he did that, his kingdom would not stand. Everybody does that now. So how do you figure your kingdom, your government's going to stand as long as you do? You don't know how to live by faith, hope, and charity. And that's what John the Baptist was preaching, to make straight the way of the Lord. The way of the Lord is to gather together and create a society in the world, but not of the world, that operates by faith, hope, and charity and the perfect law of liberty, and bind yourselves with other people by love. You think you can do that? You can't do that alone. You got to do that with other people. You know, you can't be, you know, I could put some terms here, but you can't do that alone. You've got to gather with other people, not for the purpose of them serving you, but for the purpose of you serving them, because you're not going to get blessed unless you come in the name of Christ, and Christ came to serve, so therefore you have to serve. You see how that works? But instead, what's happened is you become natural brutes and you think it's absolutely okay to take from your neighbor by force so that you can have a health clinic or welfare or food stamps or you know, whatever it is. Like I say, health care, social security, public schools, all these things of socialism. You think it's okay to force your neighbor to contribute to this. And that's the nature of a brute beast. Take what you want. But these, as a natural brute beast, made to be taken and destroyed. You see, because you'll be taken. That whole thing with Proverbs and sinners enticing, say, let's all have one purse, and let's lurk privately for blood. This is what they're talking about. And they tell you that it's not going to be their blood that's taken, it's going to be your blood. And now you're feeling the sting of this error in your thinking that it's okay to covet your neighbor's goods through government. And you're wanting to throw off that government. Well, you can't throw it off without destruction and devastation to your society and your community unless you have something to replace it. And that's why John came first, to start telling you make straight the way of the Lord. He said, same way with Moses. Pay your tally of bricks. But glean in the field at night for your straw. Start gathering together with other people. And I can guarantee you, the first people you gather together with, they ain't got this. They ain't got it down. But if they are willing to gather and work it out, start learning, practicing, they can get better. You know, first time on the ski slope, I was pretty bad. So I invited a buddy to come with me. And he was pretty bad too. At the end of the day, he was good. I mean, he wasn't a good skier, but he was a tremendous athlete, and he was coming down those hills lickety split. He's crashing into things still, but he just fell in love with it. Became a real avid skier after that. I did get better, but I never got as good as he did. But I probably didn't break as many bones as he probably ended up eventually breaking either. But the fact is that you do these things together, and you'll get better at it. And that's why you're to gather together in Christ's name, how to serve one another. Can you imagine 100,000 people, 200,000, a million people in this country of 360 million people, and they're all trying to outdo each other in ways to help you? That doesn't mean they just give you everything you want. If you don't work, you don't eat. And they rebuke you when you do wrong. But they're trying to live by faith, hope, and charity in the perfect law of liberty. They're trying to provide health, education, and welfare through charity alone. They're trying to be the Faith Emergency Ministry Auxiliary, the FEMA of the righteous, by coming together and resolving problems. You know, how do you grow a garden? How do you grow a garden without GMOs? How do you grow wheat without GMOs? Who wants to do that? Because if you want to do that, we want to buy wheat from you because we don't want GMO wheat. Well, how are you going to find those people unless you get into a network? And that's why we got the livingnetwork.org. But you have to work at it. Those Romans started with nothing. They had to work at it, and they built it, and they built it. Hundreds of years went by, and they were invincible, just like Israel had once been invincible when they organized the same way, tens, hundreds, and thousands. And the Teutons, when the Romans went up against them, 12,000 Teutons defeated 15,000 Roman soldiers in just a few days, to the man. Why? Because they were organized in the tens, hundreds, and thousands, and the Romans were forgetting what made them great. They still had, you know, better equipment, and they had, you know, all this stuff, but they had forgotten what made them great. America has forgotten what's made it great, what made it great. You see, when they came to the wilderness, they had to defend each other. They had to back up each other. When there were shortages, they had to help one another, but they knew they had to do it by free will choice. When they tried to do it through government imposition of rules from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, they starved. We're back at it again. When they said, no, when a man makes, you know, grows corn, it's his corn. When he makes something, it's his. His house is his. When they said that, starvation stopped. And that's the testimony both in Jamestown and in the places where the pilgrims were settling. And they both decided the same thing at the same time, miles apart, with no communication with cell phones, but a collective consciousness was awakened by the hardship of half the people dying every year. They came face to face with the reality that if we don't do it that righteous way, we are doomed. And we've forgotten that. And we are doomed. But there's good news. Bad times coming. That's the good news. The bad times are coming. Because it's going to knock you off your high horse. And it's going to wake you up. And right now, we're looking for those people who are waking up without getting knocked off their horse. They're waking up because something in them is stirring. Some of them have had a hard time of it. But something is waking them up. Somebody's writing on their hearts and their minds, and they're deciding to come together in the perfect law of liberty, with faith, hope, and charity. And all we're doing with the livingnetwork.org is trying to connect them up and show them some of the ways of the ancients that made nations free. And it's because they come in the character of the prophets, in the character of Christ, in the name of Christ, come to set others free. And by that, they themselves will be free. They are willing to lay down their lives for others. And if we're willing to do that, we will have life more abundant. We're willing to make the sacrifices necessary for taking back our responsibilities to one another and caring for the needy amongst us. if you're going to do it well, you're going to have to organize yourselves from the bottom up. I'm not going to appoint men over the top of you. I don't have any power to do it, don't have any interest in doing it, don't want to do it. You have to form your congregations. You have to make sure you pick ministers who connect you with the other congregations. You have to do it. Because if you're not willing to do it, you're not an asset to our society. Because our society operates by faith, hope, and charity and the perfect law of liberty. You want to force your neighbor to contribute to your welfare? You go out and talk to those natural brute beasts who love to do that. But it will be your blood that will be taken. You will be destroyed, made to be taken and destroyed because you decided to go the way of covetousness. So anyway, I encourage everybody to start connecting on a local level with other people that are starting to turn around and see what we can do. And then when there's a blizzard in South Dakota, we'll have more people calling instead of the few that we did have calling. Everybody was okay. Everybody got through it okay in our network. But there were a lot of other people that were devastated, but they're not in our network. They need to be in our network. And we'll help them rebuild, and we can find people that will help them do that. We can move people around to help them do that. The public servants of the kingdom of God want to do that. And they do it based on faith, hope, and charity. We have missionaries on the road right now helping people. We need more. We need not lots more. Where are we going to conjure those up? Don't wait for us to build it and then you come. You come and help us build it, and you'll be there already. Because it's in the building that made Rome great. It's in the building that made Christianity. Because they sought the kingdom of heaven and the righteousness of God. They were blessed by God. But if they don't go that way, then there's nothing more I can do for them. Because the slothful should not eat. And that's why, you know, everything we have on the net, it's there for free. You can download the books, download the audios, hundreds of audios, and the videos, you can download them. But that doesn't get you anywhere. You might learn something, that'd be good, and that's why we offer them. But unless you are actually gathering together in the name of Christ to help others, you will not receive the blessings of Christ. You will not be able to gather together enough. You're not smart enough. You're not able enough to make the real difference. But if you will do that, your Father will run out halfway and you will find talents that you did not know you had. You will be given powers that you did not know were accessible. You will be given a new life because you're willing to lay down some of your life for others. That's the principle. Romans learned that. They learned it in the hard way with natural disasters and throwing out the Tarquinian kings. Early Americans did it, standing for righteousness against an evil empire that was trying to foist an unwarranted usurpation. You have to remember, they were already free. Most of those men were already landed men, owning their own land, owning themselves, because that was the deal when they came here. They were still in a minority, but in that minority, they made the difference. Most of the people were in favor of Britain. Thousands, 50,000 Americans joined the British regiments to fight George Washington. But they still won because God was on their side. I can't say that about Americans today because they've gone a new way, a different system. And they've turned the whole world around and are going the wrong way. But anyway, we'll talk more about that next time on Keys of the Kingdom. Till then, may peace be upon your house and may God be with you. God bless.
Haley liked that. Thank you very much, Brother Greg.
You're welcome.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.
Well, thank you once again to Brother Gregory for being here and sharing his vast knowledge of Scripture and history. We had quite a history lesson today, so I really, really appreciated that. There's a lot of things I learned today I didn't know. No, I'll probably have to listen to that about 20 times so I can retain it, but it was incredible information. See, the Power in You is up next, and our special guest today. And every Saturday, beginning today, Kurt John Forty will be here for the first 15 minutes of our show at 4 o'clock Pacific Standard Time to bring us up to date on what he's been experiencing on the road with Prophet Organics. So we'll start off our program with that momentarily. Stay tuned, and we'll just take a short commercial break since we're at the top of the hour, and we'll be right back with you.
Vaccines are required for students, employees, immigrants, military members, and international travel. Do you know how to legally avoid them? This is vaccine rights attorney and Freedomizer radio host Alan Phillips. My vaccine exemption ebook can help you avoid the mistakes that have cost others their exemption rights. Get the authoritative guide to vaccine legal exemptions, an ebook available at freedomizerradio.com and vaccinerights.com.
Let freedom ring throughout the land.
Thank you for tuning in to Freedomizer Radio, where we have a 24/7 chat room where you can come and share what's going on in the world with people of like mind. Anything and everything against the New World Order. Dial 347-324-3704 to catch our live show. Beginning at 9 in the morning, Pacific Standard Time, Monday through Friday till midnight, and 9 to 9 on Saturday and Sunday. Take us to the beach. Take us to the park. Take us on a walk with the dog. Only on Freedomizer Radio.
Oh, you want to heal the world? Oh, you can't do that. You know, you got to elect the right people. No, change your thinking. Change the way you feel. Change the way you do things. Do everything for peace. Like John Lennon said, walk for peace. You take a shower for peace. Do whatever you do for peace.
Every time you do that, you set a ripple effect out.
Because we live in a vibrational world, and your brain is the instrument. To learn how to direct and control your mind, you guys are superheroes. You know, they don't want you to know that, but you are. You guys are the most powerful people in the world.
We see the power in you to change your thinking. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, only on Freedomizer Radio. Well, and that's what we're here for, to change your thinking and give you something else to think about, actually. And today, it's On the Road with Prophet Organics and Kurt John Forty. So welcome to the program.
Thank you, Cheryl.
You're welcome. Now, I know that since we were here last time, there's been a lot going on. And what we mean by on the road with Prophet Organics is that, you know, you're a farmer and you do a lot of your work like in your own dirt. But because of your unique position, you've been sharing with others and taking it on the road and helping others to figure out the secrets that you have figured out and share them with them. So you want to bring us up to date on what's been going on with you?
Okay. Since we initiated the Prophet Organics with the purpose of setting out a mission to show the organic farmers how to have weed-free fields, all the rest of the things just take care of themselves. There's different companies that can sell them this seed or another seed that may perform better. There's companies that have different fertilizers, and one may be better or another one equal. The price may be different. And those things can be all taken care of by themselves by other people. Our focus here is to help them get rid of the weeds in the field. If they have a weedy field, or if you have a weedy garden, there's no crop there. When we have clean crops, free of the weeds, the crops are allowed to prosper as much as the soil will give to them, or in other words, as rich as the soil is. Sandy soil will not likely produce as large a tomato as good, rich, black loam soil. And becoming involved with this, I met, of course, I've went to a lot of organic conferences and met a lot of people there, and you constantly are meeting people from different parts of the country, which this spring took me out to South Dakota, to the Sioux Falls area, and also into western Minnesota. And so becoming involved with them, talking about the project that we're doing specifically with the 12-inch corn row project, which is incredibly important to the growing of corn, and we're showing that to people by demonstrating what we're doing on this farm where we have 50 acres of corn planted that way. A week ago, on October 2nd, on a Wednesday, we had a couple of farmers from Minnesota that wanted to come over and see what our crops looked like so they could actually, you know, not just see pictures I would send them on their cell phone, but they wanted to come and look at them. So then we invited just a couple of other people there, and we were going to have a half dozen people there to just kind of take a look at it, and ended up weather conditions changed, and both of the gentlemen from Minnesota were not able to come because they had to harvest their crop. So we're still waiting for them to come over. But after we got done that afternoon, one young farmer who farms about 70 acres, which is a fairly good-sized organic farm and mostly looked upon as a very small corn farmer by the other conventional farmers, this young man was planting real wide rows, the old standard of 38-inch wide rows, and he was having a challenge, like always, to control the weeds. And so we were showing him the flow shield and the things we can do there. But when he came down and looked at what we had with Profit Organics, with the ultra-narrow row corn and how good it looked and how good a weed control that we had, even though we had wet weather and we're not able to do the tillage and everything on time, we still have a very wonderful crop and we're very, very happy with it. I took some kernel counts. In other words, a thousandth of an acre in 12-inch rows is 43.5 feet. Acre contains 43,560 square feet in an acre. So when you do yield calculations, you measure off whatever width row you have by a certain number of feet, that equates to 1,000th of an acre. So I did that, and I went out and I opened all the husks, and that's the picture that Cheryl tagged on me and moved over to the Freedomizer Radio page from my Facebook page. And I counted the kernels there, and in 1,000th of an acre, I counted the number of rows of kernels around and the kernels long, and did not count the extra kernels on the ends, so I wanted to take a conservative calculation. And I came up with that it looks like we have about 8,890,000 kernels per acre, and there's typically, in a bag of seed corn, about 80,000 kernels. And so you could divide by 80,000, but I took 90,000 to take just a little bit compensation for miscalculation or moisture content that may be there or anything. And we came up with about 98 bushels per acre that we believe that we're going to get out of that section of the field. Now, the other parts of the field may be more or less, but we have a very good yield there, considering that we planted that crop literally 30 days after it should have been in the ground. We had neighbors across the road that were chemical farmers, and they tilled and got their crop planted pretty early, and then they sprayed it and everything. And I do not know what their yields will be, but a typical county average is about 150 bushels per acre on many areas, plus or minus that a little. And so at the corn price, the conventional prices have dropped to down into the $4 ballpark. The $10 organic corn will produce more profit, more net profit likely. We haven't harvested it yet, but we anticipate that Jim, a first-year farmer, organics is easy. Some people will tell you it takes a lot of work and it's hard to switch over to organics, but he took land that had laid idle for 28 years, and the first year he has a successful crop. That's what we want to do with everyone with gardening, which is what we're going to focus on this evening later on in the show here. And so in comparing that, we're getting interest from farmers. After that day was over, I took off and went to Sioux Falls. When we talk about being on the road, I am literally on the road. And I went to Sioux Falls, South Dakota that evening, and the next morning at daylight, I was out to two organic farms that I had been talking with that were testing my product, and I wanted to see what their crops looked like before freeze down, before harvest, because I knew I wouldn't have the opportunity later. So then I went to southwestern Iowa down by Des Moines and looked at a seed company that's promoting the 12-inch corn, and they're promoting the GMO crops that they have the seed genetics that are going to give the farmers these 300 bushel yields. And they had some nice corn, and they had some that was, you know, nothing exceptional. And I wanted to see that GMO crop, what they're claiming is at the top of the line from their perspective. I wanted to see what it looked like in the field, not just pictures. I had to see what it looked like compared to what I knew that our crop in Wisconsin here looked like. So after taking a look at that, riding in the combine, seeing what they were out there doing harvesting, I then went to Madison, Wisconsin on Thursday evening. And on Friday and Saturday, I attended the World Dairy Expo, which is an annual event held the first week in October in Madison, Wisconsin. And there's many distributors there for every type of product that's sold to the farmers. And my focus was, of course, to talk to all of the seed companies and ask them what they had available for the organic industry in non-GMO seeds. And so some of the companies actually had no non-GMO seeds available. There was a couple of companies that are totally focused on only GMO hybrids because that's where they think the future is going for farming. And there's a lot of other companies that had maybe one or two or three varieties, and the only reason that they really were hanging on to them, I believe, is just to try to hang on to a customer that maybe wanted a non-GMO hybrid. They weren't really promoting it. They weren't doing research to create better crossbred hybrids. And then there were several companies that had specifically only non-GMO hybrids, and they were focusing on improving that. They believed that there was a future there. So when I told them about Profit Organics project with the 12-inch corn, which is kind of a buzzword in the agricultural world now, most everyone is aware of the 12-inch corn idea. And I told them how we had built our 16-row planter, which allows us to plant 8 rows on one side at one population and 8 rows on the other side at a lower population or a different population. So I suggested to every one of these seed companies that what I wanted to do next year in the project was I had a lot of farmers that were interested in the 12-inch corn experimenting with it, and so I asked each of them to provide me with one bushel at no charge of whatever seed corn they had that was non-GMO that they felt they wanted to see what it would do under the high populations. So what we're doing this next year, and I have a lot of participation from a lot of companies and a lot of farmers that are also participating in this, and we are going to plant a massive experimental, or I should say rather than experimental, we already know it's going to work. We're going to plant a massive demonstration plot showing for the companies what they're going to get out of providing this seed for free is that they're going to get all the test data back, and they're not going to have to put any further expense into doing this. And we're going to be able to compare it side by side in a very unique situation of this high population corn that we're growing in the organic Profit Organics project And also, side by side, we're going to plant the corn at the lower population, a little farther apart in the row, at 34,000 population, which is where most of their customers are growing corn in the wider 30-inch rows. So they're very interested in seeing where this is going, and I know that we're going to show them a very good and successful year, and this will draw farmers into it. I talked to a large crop farmer some over a week ago who wants to try this, and he's planting like over 3,000 acres of corn. He wants to plant a lot of corn on every different type of soil he has to see where he can go with this. And he just, in our conversation, I could tell that he was just short of thinking about the possibility of taking his couple thousand cow dairy operation all to certified organic milk, because he could make a lot of money at it, and he wouldn't have to monkey with the chemicals, and he would have good crops. This is important to the farmers. They have to make money, and they also want the pride and satisfaction of having good-looking crops. Just as each one of us here listening today, if we're going to have a garden, we don't want to go out in the garden and hunt through the weeds to find a few vegetables. We want to go out there and see a nice, productive garden that's easy to pick the crop, have good quality vegetables, and not have to fight the weeds, and have a personal pride in that we grew our food that way by ourselves. In the day that I talked down in the 2 days at the World Dairy Expo, I found it very interesting that I only run into one farmer who I was acquainted with from my area who was a little bit, I'll say, lukewarm about the project that we were doing. My point is, I'm getting a very positive response of more than 90% of the farmers I've talked to, that they are interested in this possibility that they could grow organic crops and make money at it. And they're being ethical and good for the stewardship of the land is just frosting on the cake for them. So that kind of concludes where I was at in this last week. And I'm going to go into the garden explanation here right now. And what we're going to start with on growing a garden. All of us would like to have that garden. Oh, go ahead, Cheryl.
You shared something with me over the weekend from the dairy farmers convention. And I would like for you to share your impression of what you saw in the big red truck. What do you see? Can you share that with the audience,
my.
Please?
Cheryl, since the last time I talked to you, I have totally had that subject out of my mind. And I just thought about that this moment. I have not thought about that one single time since we last talked. And you'll remember that I've said that instead of trying to fight the big chemical companies or Monsanto or anything else that way, only focus on producing a successful crop. Focus on the non-GMO crops. And when we say non-GMO, the thought comes to our mind the opposite, that there is GMO crops. But I've totally forgotten about that, and it was such a significant thing. I went by this one big semi. And it was a full-size semi, like a refrigerated trailer truck. And it had two slide-outs on it, like a recreational motorhome that has the slide-out bedroom or the slide-out living room. They had a slide-out on each side, so it made that truck double-wide. You walked into the back end up a stairway, and then they had an exit on the front end. When you came inside, they had a little miniature theater in there for about, I'm guessing they could have seated 25, 30 people at a time. And they had a little, I can't remember, 10 or 15-minute video that they showed. What was it, Cheryl, on the road with a grow or something? Do you remember what the title was of that?
I'm going to pull it up while you're speaking.
Okay. Anyway, they were promoting, of course, the GMO high-tech farming. They came on with this guy, and I don't remember what his name was, but he kind of looked like Jesse Ventura that was governor here up in Minnesota. And, you know, he had the short sleeve shirt, you know, the big wrestler looking physique. And he was talking about how that something that bothered him was all the children that were going hungry. And they pulled up some figures that one out of five in Los Angeles or one out of seven in New York didn't know where the next meal was coming from. And without going into all of those things, it was quite a emotional appeal how that there was a crisis that we needed to produce more food as if we don't have enough food now. And so they started to talk about how that the high-tech farming and the genetic engineering offered the possibility to increase yields and that they were going to feed the world with their high-tech food. And then they did a kind of a, kind of a question and answer thing, kind of like what Jay Leno or David Letterman will do, where they go out on the street and they ask people questions, and they're kind of like loaded questions, and sometimes they get really off-the-wall answers or answers that they make fun of the people almost when they give them their answer. And they were asking questions like, or making statements rather, that there was no difference between organic food and non-organic food, and there was no proven difference. And they kept repeating this to the point of, you know, it was like a brainwashing thing. And a lot of the things that they were saying were outright untruths, or they were half-truths, as I understand things, and they were only telling half of the truth, which left the rest of the assumption to believe that it wasn't worth going the organic route. And as I was watching it, it actually, you know, kind of made me a little upset to my stomach, like, they're that serious out here? They're putting this much time and energy into trying to destroy the idea of the organic movement. And they were telling how it's not worth paying all that extra money for the food. And I believe that with more production, higher production of the organic farms and bringing more farmers into this profitable production on the farm, that we are going to lower the organic food prices in this country. And like I gave the example on the last show of the box of cornflakes that only has 10 cents worth of corn at a good, decent conventional price, and that at the double price of the organic only raised the price 10 cents. So that's not my department. That's marketing for somebody to figure out that we can have organic food and we do not have to pay a double price for it. It is worth a premium, and it doesn't have to be an arm and a leg that makes it unavailable to the average person.
Right. It was.
Is there anything you want to add to that show?
Yeah, the program is called Chew on This, and I put several articles in on my Facebook page, facebook.com/seethepower, and just look for the photograph of the big red truck, and you will see that, I mean, they're really pushing this whole thing about the fact that, you know, that farmers can change how they feed the world based on just buying GMO products. And when I did a little digging, extra digging, foodworldprize.org was one of the sites that they referenced to send you out to so that you can help. You know, that's under the section, you can help. Now, if you've been listening to See the Power in You, you know that the World Food Prize is backed by Monsanto, and they are giving out their World Food Prize to Monsanto GMO producers. There are two other organizations out there, and it's not listed under Chew on This. The website to go and find this is drivetofeed.com. And then you can go and do your own research to find out how this company, this organization, is spreading propaganda. I mean, it's basically Monsanto propaganda. and using a former athlete that looks very much like Jesse Ventura. And that's the interesting thing is that when you look at him, when you listen to him, if you didn't know for sure, it's like maybe if you just in passing, the very first impression that you get is Jesse Ventura. That's the feeling that you get. That's the name that pops into your mind if you're not a follower of these wrestlers and these other athletes. And so and because Jesse Ventura is so well known for his digging around in the truth, to me that's just a blatant subliminal use of a celebrity to further their purposes. So I hope that you'll go and check out all of their see what they're doing. And it's not just the dairy industry. They're hitting the poultry industry as well. So there you go. The drive.
And I have to add, Cheryl, I thought it was Jesse Ventura when he first started speaking. Until I think they give his name, or else I kind of decided it wasn't him. But I thought, I had the impression it was him. And he's gained quite a bit of respect when he became the governor of Minnesota. And so, you know, that's just what the propaganda is, to use somebody that somebody likes or admires, and then people want to embrace what their beliefs are.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, we've reached the bottom of the hour. It is time for us to take a little short commercial break. And when we get back, we're going to get into preparing your garden for the winter with Kurt John 40 and Prophet Organic. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back. That went by really fast. It's amazing how quickly.
Oh, man. You know, it's like sometimes you think, 2 hours. What can I talk about for 2 hours? And I went to the coffee shop this morning at 8:30, and I left at 11 o'clock. Can you believe that?
Yes, I can. Yes, I can. Okay. Well, just after this short commercial break, we'll be right back with Kurt John 40. So stay tuned.
Hey, Freedomist, join me. Proof Negative, weeknights 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific. As we fight the New World Order together, right here on Freedomizer Radio, your exclusive home of the Proof Negative Show.
Learn the vegan truth with MC Fructose.
Oh, yeah! MC Fructose in the house!
Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific Time to learn how you can improve your health, lose weight, and reverse disease by following a diet of fresh, raw, ripe, organic fruits and vegetables void of any animal products. We'll have interviews with pioneers, doctors, and athletes thriving on a low-fat vegan diet. This is The Vegan Truth.
If people ask the way you get your protein from, you can tell them all the food to eat contains some. Truth be told, we don't need that much, so excuse me while I eat my favorite fruit for lunch.
How do you wake up in the morning? Do you jump out of bed with a smile? Or do you hit the snooze button over and over again? Tune in each Friday at 12 p.m. Pacific Time to Wake Up and Live. I'm your host, Christine Siegel. On my show, you will learn valuable health and wellness tips that will boost your energy levels. Are you eating a sad diet? Learn how to find quality, nutrient-dense foods. Life is what you make of it. Only you can change your life. You are that important. Join me, Christine Siegel, on Wake Up and Live here on Freedomizer Radio.
Okay, well, we're back, and Miss Cookie has requested to join us, so here she is. Good afternoon,
well,
Cookie.
I just wanted to say hi, and Kurt, what an excellent job, and I'm looking forward to learning about organic gardening.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to tell everybody what I've learned, and mostly what I'm talking about here is things that I've learned on the large farm acreage, and I'm simply applying it back to a small tract of land. And instead of using large tractors or large tillage pieces of equipment, we have to adapt back to a smaller, perhaps a rototiller, a tractor-mounted rototiller, or if the garden is really small, depending on where you live, perhaps just a spade and working with hand tools.
I used to organic garden about 30 years ago, but I did it with, like, you know, putting marigolds between things and using my chicken manure and, you know, using garlic and onions and different things to put between things to keep the animals out of the garden, because we had deer and ducks and geese and different things that just roamed, and they would stay out of the garden because of the fact that I, you know, did it the way the book said to do it, to keep them out of your garden. But I loved organic gardening.
Yes, and just 2 days ago, coming back from the area where we have the Profit Organics project, about, oh, I think it's 3 miles down the road, I've always noticed this organic garden vegetable sign there, and there's not too much happening there. They had a couple of acres that they were tilling, and I was always in such a hurry going by, and I just never had time to stop and introduce myself to them. And because I'm building a greenhouse over this last planted project, I happened to notice that on their greenhouse, they had plastic on it, and they had a couple of hoop houses there. And I went past the place, and I thought, I have to go and talk to them. So I turned around, went back, talked to them, just for the specific purpose of finding out where they bought their plastic, or if they had some extra smaller, older sheets of plastic that I could get, because I didn't need it for very long. And we got talking. He is now interested in working with us, and we are going to do some things with his gardening and some experimental plots there that we will also put a page on Profit Organics, specifically with Bob's farm there. And so it was such an exciting meeting to sit there, and we just fell right into a conversation for about a half an hour or 45 minutes, even though neither one of us had very much time to spare. We just had to talk about some things, and we know that this is going to add. He was telling me some very successful things that he was doing, and so those things will be added to the Profit Organic site so that we can sponsor his farm under Bob's Garden or whatever we should choose to title it on that page, and perhaps a couple of different places for other people's farms. Each of the farmer experiments that we're doing, we're going to label the page by that farm name. So if we work with 3 dozen different farmers, we'll end up with 3 dozen different pages with 3 dozen different farmers and their large farms or small farms. So one farm might be, you know, John Doe, 50 acres. The next one might be Jim Doe, 500 acres, and so on. And so anyway, we had a good visit there. And we were talking about where, actually, the first point that I'm going to talk about tonight, we talked about his farm, and he was talking about some wet soil conditions and the challenges that he had with getting weed control. And so we were talking about, okay, location, where we're going to put these experimental plots so that they don't get flooded by unexpected rain, or get a lot of rain and then have it in a swampy area that our efforts are just useless because we don't get any data out of it. And so The first thing that I would like to suggest to everyone listening to the show is an assessment of where to put your garden. Some of you may have homes with large backyards or additional acreage. Some may have a small backyard, and some may have a very small or little or no backyard. And the next step would be planters. Like instead of having a flower planter along the window, perhaps you could put radishes in between your flowers and grow a few fresh vegetables that way. But I don't want to go back to that smaller approach to it right now. Right now I want to do the common size garden. What were you going to say?
Hold on just a second, Kurt, before you get any deeper. We have a caller with a comment or a question. Can we take that first?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Okay, very good. So, caller from area code 507, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's Howard from Minnesota. You were talking about Jesse's body. Go ahead.
I didn't hear the question.
No, Jesse lives in Mexico 6 months out of the year. Now he's going to start a big talk TV show, I think it is, down there. But he was down on Monsanto. He was on a program recently, and he's against it. And he had to quit the governor.
Okay, that's good to know.
He quit the governorship because his wife got sick, but he's had quite success exposing the truth. And I got to bring up something. I had a friend tell me the computer internet's wild on the cattle of South Dakota. They faced the storm and they had their tongue out and their nostrils swelled up, and now the white-tailed deer have the same disease. And I was told it might be Roundup. So Monsanto and me don't get along too good. So I yield.
I hear you. Okay. Well, thanks for checking in, Howard. We appreciate that.
Well, I hope I've done some good.
Yes, I just wrote down those notes. I want to run that by a couple of people, and maybe we can come back with a comment later on what we find out about that. I've been just finding out that this Roundup genetically engineered corn is not healthy for the cattle. And this is a really interesting comment, and I thank you, Howard, for bringing that up, because it brings up another question. Sometimes we put out the knowledge there of what we do know, and sometimes what we really need from people is a good question that causes us to think, what if? When we bring that question, what if, it brings out the genius in every single person to think, what if I did this or what if I did that? And now we start exploring the possibilities, which is where we find the answers. Getting directly to the garden show here right now, the first thing, I made out a few notes. Oh, did I hear you say ask something, Cheryl?
No. Go ahead.
Okay, forgive me. The first thing that I wanted to do was I laid out a little bit of a general set of notes here that will keep me on track to focus on what's important to each person listening and how they want to approach planting a garden next spring. And very exciting, this afternoon I stopped to visit an organic farmer of where we rent the land from him, on the guy that I farm with. And he had some other friends there, and I told him about Freedomizer Radio and the program tonight. And all there was like seven people there helping him. They were making firewood for the winter. And so I give them a little quick rundown of what we were going to talk about tonight. And the wife of the one gentleman was there. It was like, oh, wow, that makes sense. Oh, yeah, that would make it easier. And so it really energized me this afternoon that what I had to say was of value to this young couple. They were, 35, 40-ish probably. And so they had family. They had teenage daughters and such. And so that organic food, and they were talking about the price of it. They'd like to have it, but they have to grow their own. They felt it was just out of their budget range to eat all organic food. And that should not be that we feel that we can't afford to have the best, which reminds me of a story my first father-in-law told me once of the man he rented the farm from. They had no children, and so they helped him on the farm, and they were going to sell six Hereford steers to the market, and they were going to keep one of them for butcher for themselves, and the landlord would have the half, and then Clifford and his family would have the half. And Clifford picked out one of the smaller ones that didn't quite look as fat, and he said, oh, we'll keep that one for butchering ourselves. And the older man, the owner, says, nothing doing. We're eating that one. He wanted the fattest one, the best one, because he says, we grew those steers. He says, if we're not entitled to eat the best, who is? And I never forgot that statement, that we're entitled to eat good food. We're entitled to have freedoms, and with those freedoms also comes responsibilities, and that gets into another conversation. And if I can get back here now, I'll get back to the focus here that I have with the garden show.
Okay.
The first thing that I want to bring as a point to everyone listening is the assessment of where to put your garden. Take a look around your property. You may have a sunny area, or you may have an area that's covered with shade. If it's constantly covered with shade, you're not likely going to get much of a garden because the sunlight is going to the trees and not to your vegetables. So you want a sunny area, and also a sunny area will likely warm up early. If you have like a southern slope or a bank or a little slope to the land that leans to the west, it will have a good afternoon sun. Now, depending on the soil type, that could be a detriment later in the summer. If you have a sandy area, that could be really hot, and then it would simply require watering. So look for a sunny area, preferably, and then assess your soil type. You'll either have a sandy soil type, or you might have a brown clay soil type that gets really sticky, and it's a little bit more difficult to work if it's wet. Sandy ground can be tilled when it's a little bit wet, and you don't destroy the soil structure. Clay ground, if you work it wet or too early in the spring, then you can make clumps the size of golf balls and baseballs, and those don't grow a crop. They're hard to get germination, and you just kind of destroy your opportunity to have a good crop. The best soil, if you have it, is a black loam. Any kind of a black or darker soil usually has a higher organic content. The higher organic content will have more nutrients in it, and it also will have a better water holding capacity, which will help your crops to make it through dry weather and such. Then also, the next thing is to assess the soil fertility of the area that you choose to have your garden. Now, you can take a soil test, and it'll cost you money to find out what nutrients are available or what that you maybe should add to it to produce a crop. But the easiest and the most inexpensive way is simply to assess whether there's good grass growing on the ground right now, or if it's a corner of the yard that's just growing up into big, tall weeds, and it always grows big, tall weeds. If it grows big, tall weeds, or if it grows a lot of grass that needs mowing often, likely you're not going to have to add any fertility to that soil, and you'll grow a big, beautiful garden from it if you keep the weeds out of it, and that's easy. If you have weeds or grass on it, you want this fall, you want to either, if possible, till that grass or till the weeds into the soil. Those weeds will break down just like if you take lawn clippings and make a pile of a compost pile. It'll eventually turn to humus and become good soil fertilizer again. Also, blending those weeds or grass into the soil with a rototiller, for example, talking about a power machine, the soil bacteria get around each of those little particles of grass, and the soil's around each particle of grass, and it starts the decomposition process. Now, if you have so much grass or so many big, tall weeds that you go in there with your rototiller, and if any of you are familiar with what a rototiller is, it's a small gas-powered motor that has a shaft horizontal on the bottom, and it'll usually have about four tines, two sets of tines on each side, and it'll till up approximately a 30-inch or 24-inch wide area. And so if you go into weeds, if you've not did it before, the first thing that will happen is it'll wrap that grass and weeds around the shaft and around the tines, and you won't accomplish anything. So you need to do one of two things to put that grass or weeds into the soil. One, if you want to till it in, you can take a lawnmower and go over those weeds, and if you're on the edge of a lawn and the weeds are kind of big, you might not want to take a full swat with the lawnmower, whether it's a push or a rider. Just take a part of a swat so it's easy on the mower, and let the blades chop the grass or the weeds up into a lot of fine particles like confetti, And by the time you go back and forth across that, all of a sudden that big bushy weeds or grass area is now laying in a fine mulch on the soil, perhaps cut up into 1 or 2 inch long particles or a half inch long particle. Then you can come along with the rototiller and easily blend that into the soil. Now, when you want to blend that in, you don't want to dig very deep. You want to blend it into the top couple inches of soil and then come back maybe a week later and blend it in again. We use a process called reverse tillage in the farming, which does things in a reverse order of the normal way of doing things. The old ways that farmers used to till was they used a moldboard plow to turn the soil over upside down, or in recent years they started to use what was called a chisel plow, which was nothing more than a big digger with tines about a foot apart, which ripped up the soil and tipped the soil up on top, but it didn't bury all of the crop residue, whether it was corn or weeds or grass. It left it blended on the top of the soil. A moldboard plow generally tips it over upside down and buries all of that crop under the furrow. I prefer not to plow it down and bury it underneath, because then you can bury that weeds and grass so deep that it gets down into the anaerobic area where the anaerobic bacteria do not decompose it. You need oxygen to decompose organic matter. And so generally, I would say about the top 6 inches of the soil is alive with a aerobic bacteria. So when you blend those weeds and grass into the top, you're putting that bacteria in contact with that material, with the moisture that's in the soil. They go to work and have a smorgasbord feast, and they start to decompose that. After that bacteria explosion happens, then you come back a week later and till it again and till it a little bit deeper. And then you blend that crop into the soil a little bit deeper, and you deepen the area of the aerobic bacteria, and so then you're getting more of that organic matter decomposed. And this works the same for a big farmer's field or as it does for a small garden. If it's not possible for some reason or another, there's too much weeds and you just don't have a lawnmower that'll do it, you may have to remove the weeds, or if the garden is out in an area where it's acceptable to burn, you could burn the grass off on an area, but you want to make sure that, first of all, an ordinance, if you live in a town area or anything, that it allows doing that, and or that you don't start a fire that would be uncontrolled. You could remove some of that grass and make a smaller fire, you know, remove it with a fork or a rake, burn it, and then drag a little bit more of it back over onto the garden and burn a small amount of it at a time so you can control a smaller fire rather than light the whole garden on fire and have a big bonfire from too many weeds or something. So you have to use discretion and safety there. But burning also will release the carbon and it will help to make a better crop. And I did that one time on a field that had been not used for a year, and there was just so much foxtail growing there. It was just a tremendous crop of it. And I had worked the soil on 40 acres all the way around this small 2-acre field. And so the wind was blowing from one way, and I safely lit it, and it burned out in a few minutes, 15, 20 minutes. It burned the whole field up, and I grew a very good crop of corn on it. I think they do that practice down in Kansas on the wheat fields where that they burn the straw to put the nutrients back into the soil. But use your discretion and make sure that you're not starting something that's uncontrollable there. One thing that you want to do for the garden for next year is you want to do something with the soil in the fall, which makes it easier in the spring. First of all, part of the work is simply done. If you wait until 2 days before you're going to plant a crop, you have to plant, you have to do all of the work right now, and it's just a lot of work to do. So doing a little bit of it in advance just makes it easier, but also it puts you in a better position to grow a crop by causing the weed seeds to grow. When you till it in the fall, the biggest advantage that you have is that it kills any of the perennial grasses or perennial weeds that might be there. You cut them up into small pieces. If you plow it over in one big furrow, you simply trip the grass upside down, and then the grass will just sit there dormant, and then it'll come back in the spring, and it just starts growing. The reason we use what we call reverse tillage and using a rototiller to cut shallow is you cut the top off the plant. You cut the base of the plant off from the root system. And then the sunlight in a day or two will dry that little short 1-inch or 2-inch root that you cut off and the base of the plant, and it'll just dry it out. Then you come back and till it again, and you till a little bit deeper. Now you cut the roots off again. And so each time you come back and till, you're going to cut the roots up into many more small pieces, and they can't overwinter. There's enough root nutrients left there for them to overwinter and start off. But if you just plow it over and leave a long grass root, usually it will survive, and then you've got quack grass or grasses to deal with in your garden. So a proper job of tillage in the fall, making it black in the fall, will eliminate the perennials for the next spring. Then doing tillage in the spring helps to start the weeds to growing, because the ultraviolet sunlight triggers the germination of the seed. So when you till the soil, that's what triggers the germination of that seed. So if you wait until right before you're going to plant a garden and do all of your tillage, you tilled it deep, you triggered the germination of thousands and thousands of seeds that all start growing at one time. Whereas if you wanted to plant your garden, we'll say a target date of the 25th of May, and you started tilling in the latter part of April and just tilled it once a week until the end of May, you've got 4 tillage passes on it. You've started 4 batches of weeds, and you've germinated and destroyed most of the weeds, making it easier to grow a crop. One little note here I put in was that about 30 years ago, I was plowing ground in the fall. I was plowing over the cornfield in the fall to prepare it for oats planting in the spring. And we always did fall plowing because the dirt was bare, and then we would usually be able to plant 2 or 3 weeks earlier in the spring and get a better oats crop. Well, when I was plowing, it started freezing up one night. I was plowing all night, and it froze up so much I could not plow more than about 4 rounds around the field, and I had a 3-bottom plow. So I only had about a 16-foot-wide swat plowed on the outside of this bigger field, and I finally just gave up plowing because I just wasn't doing a good job. The next spring, I came in with the same tractor and the same plow and finished plowing the field. And of course, the ground was nice and mellow, and I thought, wow, it wasn't worth doing that last fall because it looks so nice and pretty here now when I'm plowing. Except that when we planted the oats, and the oats came, and it was a beautiful-looking crop, and then it started raining about harvest, and so harvest got delayed a little bit. The center of the field was full of weeds, got grown over. The nice yellow, golden ripe oats were hidden by the greenness of the field. We could still see some of it, but it looked more like a green field than golden. And the outside 16 feet, or the outside 2 rounds with the combine that we had, was nice, clean oats. And so that was when I learned the value of the fall tillage. So I'm just simply passing that on to you, that you can have that same advantage. And my dad used to say that a poor job of tillage in the fall was better and worth more than the best job you could do in the spring. So do something in your garden this fall. Just get it tilled up any which way you can, and whatever you do this fall will benefit you in the spring as much or more than whatever you do in the spring. On the fertility, we've already covered that with mulching. Composting is one other thing that can be added to your garden. If you don't have weeds there, or if you do have some weeds there or grass that you've tilled in, and it's not as much of a, it wasn't a really good looking crop of grass or weeds, and without spending the money for testing, maybe you're better to spend that money for just a little fertilizer or a little humus. If there's availability of a cow farm or a horse farm or something that you can maybe go and get some dried manure, that would be an advantage to put that on. And also to blend that into the soil in the fall. In the organic rules, you're not even allowed to put organic cow manure on an organic vegetable garden because the raw manure has bacteria in it and it will flavor the vegetables undesirably. So when you use raw manure, you want it applied in the fall and you want it blended into the soil so that the soil bacteria have time to break it down, decompose it, and make those nutrients available to the next crop. You can apply old manure, what we call old manure, or like a rotted manure pile. If there was a horse farm or a dairy farm that perhaps had a manure pile setting off to the side of the barnyard or something that had, the farmer said, well, that's been there for a year, that's already broken down. You can apply that in the springtime and have good results with no negative results to it.
Okay, good. You know, as we're coming to this, we're coming up to the top of the hour again, so we'll take another short commercial break while you regather your thoughts for the next punch. How's that?
I just had to change pages here.
Okay. I also, so we'll take a short commercial break, and we'll be right back. So stay tuned for more on preparing your garden for the wintertime.
Did you know that healthcare workers around the U.S. are required to get flu shots they don't want to avoid losing their jobs? Or that some state laws allow children to consent to vaccines that can injure or kill them? Join vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips and co-host Debbie Brook Thursdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 11 Mountain, 12 noon Central, and 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. Learn about your rights and the latest vaccine news from around the world right here on Freedomizer Radio.
Let freedom ring throughout the land.
Be sure to support our affiliate, Silverleaf Tea and SodaStream. And you order products from them, please let them know that you heard about them on Freedomizer Radio.
I'm an American. Red, white, and blue. And I'm a citizen.
This just in on Freedomizer Radio. Breaking news. Jay and the Duke have just taken over the entire bandwidth for 90 minutes every Friday night from 9 to 10:30 Eastern Time to spread the message of faith and freedom. The First Amendment to the Constitution prevents any force of tyranny from stopping them. Red Alert, I repeat, the Red Alert. The revolution has just seized the radio. It's We Still Believe, the radio revolution.
Welcome, Freedomizers. This is Juan Hicks of Juan's Media Matrix. Be sure to tune into my show every Tuesday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. From time to time, I'll be featuring special guest interviews along with the latest news headlines from around the world. You're always welcome to call into the show by dialing 347-324-3704 and pressing 1. Otherwise, you can listen to the latest show in progress. Be sure to join us also at www.freedomizerradio.com on your computer or tablet, where you can interact with our listeners in the chat room as well as comment on the show. We also have a large variety of shows throughout the broadcast day at www.freedomizerradio.com, each with its own unique host covering a wide range of topics to keep you informed on issues that the mainstream media refuses to touch. Once again, that's www.freedomizerradio.com, or you can listen by phone by calling 347-324-3704. Be sure to tune in.
And remember, our call-in number is 347-324-3704. Just press 1 on your handset if you'd like to make a comment or if you have a question. And we'll be right back.
There's something wrong. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind. The Matrix is everywhere. You have to see it for yourself. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television.
Join me, Austin Gorilla Thomas, Saturday nights, 6 to 7.30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 9 to 10.30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Unraveling the Matrix, only on Freedomizer Radio.
All I'm offering is the truth.
Okay, and for those of you who have small gardens and small yards and you cannot till, please let me recommend backtoedenfilm.com. Go and check that out. You'll find that that's very agreeable for those of us with back problems, et cetera. Kurt, now where did we leave off?
We left off talking about fertility. And I had one more comment to add to that, and that's to just simply assess, do you have a big area for a garden available to you, or are you limited? Are you having such a small area that you're finding difficulty to cram your garden into that area? That would be a decision that would be affected by whether you want to add fertility or not. If you have a lot of garden area, it probably is not necessary to spend any money on fertilizer to try to grow more when you have a lot of space and simply a little extra seed. And, for example, having more area with some smaller tomatoes, you'll have just as much tomato soup or tomato juice as you need, whereas if you have a very small, limited area, you may want to add a little humus or fertility of some type available from a gardening center or whatever of your choice, or a farm. And then you may want to try to grow as many vegetables per square foot or as much productivity on a per acre basis, which is the way we farmers talk, is getting the most fertility or the most production off from a given amount of acreage. So whether you have a big or small area, that may temper your decision of whether you want to spend any money at all for fertilizer or take a year and just see what you get. And if it was growing grass or weeds, it'll grow some kind of a garden for you. And if you have enough area, you'll likely have plenty of vegetables. One other thing you can do for fertility in the fall, depending on where you live in the world, if you have a growing season available yet, here in Wisconsin, we are expecting a frost in about the next 10 days to 2 weeks. Likely, we're going to get a killing frost. And so our growing season will be over. You can plant a crop like rye, which is a perennial that we plant for a cover crop over winter. And even though you plant it now and it might start to freeze, it still stands a chance of establishing itself, getting a short 1 or 2 inch long spear coming out. But for the most part, we're too late to do any fall planting. If you live in an area where you have some growing season left, you can plant one of two things in the fall to grow some what we would call green manure. You can plant oats, and that grows up like a lawn. You can plant it fairly thick since we have a shorter amount of time in the fall left to grow. And if it gets up a foot tall, you can mow that off and then with your lawnmower and just mulch it down and then till it in. So you grew you grew some organic matter there. And that'll pull up some nutrients, and when that decomposes, those will become available to the plants again. You also can plant rye, which will grow now, and then it'll start growing in the spring. So you have a nice green crop in the spring there to look at. And rye will get very big. It can get 5-6 feet tall, and usually will get at least 4 feet tall. So at some point, you can have a problem with trying to mulch this back into the ground if you don't have a really good lawnmower or something. So then you may want to take the rye down when it was only 12 inches or 18 inches tall, mow it down, and then till it in. But green manures are a very good and inexpensive way to grow some organic matter to put into that soil. Also, you could grow the oats or you could grow the rye
remove it, make a compost pile, and then have that to add back to the garden at a later date. Composting manure, you can apply that compost that I said before in the spring, and remember that you do not want to apply any kind of undigested manure in the springtime when you're planning to have those vegetables in a few weeks or a couple of months. The green manure feeds virtually a bacterial explosion in the soil. So when you put that material down into the soil, they have food to eat, and the bacteria will multiply many times over when they're able to eat on that crop that's plowed down, and that will add what we call tilth to the soil, or another word would be a fluffiness to the soil. Instead of hard, compacted soil, your soil will become nice and mellow. That's another barometer you can go by to go out and dig down with your hand, not just with a shovel. In nice, mellow organic gardens, you often can go in there and just scoop the dirt out with your bare hands and quickly and easily dig 4, 5, 6 inches deep. In some of the conventional sprayed cornfields, that ground becomes very hard, and it's actually hard to dig it with a tool, and it takes a lot of horsepower and big tillage equipment, and so they're spending a lot of money to till this ground back up, to loosen it back up, and part of the problem was their method of farming, spraying it, killing all the weeds, killing all of the bacteria in the soil, and you kind of end up getting a dead soil similar to cement is a little strong word to use, but we, as farmers, we say, yeah, the ground's like cement out there, and it simply means it's hard and not very penetratable. Sometimes I start discussing things ahead of myself, and then I find them on my notes again, so then I don't want to repeat myself. One more thing that I wanted to add on mulching, or taking a lawnmower to grind up any grass or weeds that might be on the garden area, is that generally a typical lawnmower will cut those things up into good particles. Some lawnmowers also have an attachment available called a mulcher, and it's just different chopping blades. It may do a better job. It may or may not be worth spending the money to do that. For the most part, taking a handheld grinder or a hand file, simply sharpening up the blades so they're razor sharp underneath, will do a good job of cutting that material up. One thing about working, if you have a green growing crop, in the springtime, you want to make sure that you work it into the soil 1 to 2 weeks ahead of your desired planting date. One, it allows you the time to get the work done before you want to get your garden planted without being in a rush. It allows the bacteria to start working to decompose it, makes the soil nutrients available, and the organic matter eventually converts to humus. So that 1 to 2 week period of time will give your soil a little bit of a, I don't know if I want to use the word rest, but it just kind of stops doing what it was doing. It kills down the green material, and now it's ready to accept the new seeds and grow the intended crop. When you plant the garden, that's pretty much all I have to give to you for now for preparation. I'm just going to throw out a couple thoughts here on when you actually come to the point of planting your garden, so you can think about this. When you plant your garden, you want the soil to be drier. You do not want to work it if it's wet. If you're wet, you step on it with your foot, it makes like a brick shoe print. And so if you pack the soils in around the seeds when they're too wet, it'll affect the germination. The seed has a hard time coming out of the ground. The roots have a hard time permeating the soil next to it. So the best way to do it is to plant the ground, plant the garden in loose, dry soil, plant at the recommended planting depth that's given to you on the seed packets for the different types of seeds. And when you get done planting your garden, set up a sprinkler and simply water the garden as if you got a nice half inch or 1 inch rain, and that rain will
cause the soil particles to just set together, and they'll sink in right around the seeds, and you'll get good soil-to-seed contact, and that seed will start to draw the moisture out of it, around it from the soil particles, and you'll get a nice even soil, nice even germination, and so all of your plants will come up at the same time. If you have variable soil moisture, or if you press it in more or less, sometimes part of the row will come up when another part of the row has not come up yet. In determining how much water to put on, I had rented a farm one time about an hour south of where I live, and I didn't know how much they put on for watering, so I asked one of the neighbors, how much do I water and how often? He says, put on minimum of 3/4 of an inch once a week, whether you think it needs it or not, or whether it's just rained or not. And so this particular farm that I had rented had two irrigation pivots on it that made a full circle, but they were close enough together that one of them had to be out of the way so the other one could make the circle, and the tip of the end of it, of the outside of the circle, came within 5 feet of the center of the other one. So then you had to park that one out of the way and let the other one go around. So I did what he recommended and did 3/4 of an inch once a week all summer long. And I would turn them on, and he would go over and shut them off for me, and then I'd go back a day or two later and start up the other one and do my monitoring and checking on things. And so I watered each end of the field once a week, but the middle part of the circle was kind of an I-shaped, double-watered spot. When I came in to harvest the soybeans in the fall, we had an electronic yield monitor on the combine, and on the outside corners where the circle did not water, there was only 25 to 28 bushels of soybeans per acre, which was a good price, and I was happy with that. When I got into the watered area, it jumped by 10 bushels per acre, and as I kept going back and forth and farther into the field, I would go from 28 bushel beans to 38 bushel beans to 52 bushel beans where there was double watered. The point is, we put 1.5 inches of water on the middle of the field every week. More importantly, that middle of the field did not go more than a 4 or 5 day at the most before it got more watery. So the point that I'm making is that a little more frequent watering, especially if you have drier soils, sandy soils, or live in a very hot area, may be more beneficial, and once a week watering may not be sufficient. Ideally, you can use a sprinkler system that you can purchase at a garden center or lawn center or something. If you don't have that, or if you just have a small area, you can just fill it up with a water bucket and sprinkle it out or pour the water out. You can pour the water in between the rows and saturate it in between the rows, and the roots will come out and pick up the water. If you're using a sprinkler system, to determine how much water you're actually putting on, either use a rain gauge or simply set out 2-3 coffee cups in different areas that are straight-sided coffee cups, so you can simply look in them and see that you have 1/2 inch or 1 inch of water in there. When you plant your garden, keep the soil moist, and so that just the surface is dry and it's moist right below it. You just drag your finger across the soil, and if you hit moisture 1/4 inch down, then you've got nice moisture for germinating that seed. You don't want to water too much after the seeds germinate. You want to hold off the watering a little to let it dry out on the top and force those roots to go both horizontally for water and go deeper for water. If you water too much, or if it rained every single day, the roots will not go down because they're waterlogged and they literally like drown. And so then a crop will put the roots across, close to the surface, very shallow. So then if you end up with dry weather later, those crops will suffer and either die or be very poor performing, or you're going to have to be out there watering them every couple of days. So after you get your crop established, then let it go a little bit and establish a deeper root system. We talked about compost piles.
Compost piles can be made from lawn clippings. They can also be made from dog and cat waste. And I would suggest to not put the kitty litter into it. I'm not even sure what's all in that, but it probably is things that you don't want in your garden. The other thing you can make in a compost pile would be leaves, raking the lawn, or taking leaves, perhaps even a truckload of leaves from the city when they collect leaves. Small branches can also be cut up, broken up into small particles, blended in with a pile of leaves, and instead of sending them into the garbage to go off into the landfill, you can turn those branches back into humus, the same as grass or leaves. Organic matter all eventually goes back to becoming humus after the bacteria have worked on it enough that a scientist can no longer determine whether the humus was made from grass or from plants or animals or a tree. Humus is humus, and it's the end result of bacterial action on organic matter.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a compost pile, you want to pile it up, blend the different types of things together, and wet it down good to start it to heat, or start the rotting or the decomposing process. Eventually, you want to stir it up a little bit. It'll kind of seal itself off, and so stirring it up, getting some oxygen in it, will cause it to heat up more. You're creating a better environment for the aerobic bacteria. You also could lay, like a, depending on how big your pile was, just to recycle it, you could lay like a black garbage bag that would draw the sun's heat, and that would heat the pile up and add some a little like an igniter to the burning pile, or burning is a little strong word. It will get very hot in there when that crop starts to ferment. Also, you can buy compost barrels, or you can make your own compost barrel from looking at, I'm sure there's websites how to make them. And simply looking at some of the ones that are available for purchase, you also could make one if you didn't want to buy one. Those, usually, I think they recommend going out there once a week or once every 2 weeks and just taking a crank and turning the barrel over a couple of times. And all that's doing is reintroducing more oxygen into it to break that material down. Once your crop starts coming out of the ground and you see the corn or the beans or whatever coming up, there's a period of time between planting and the crop emergence that weeds are also germinating. Now, in the farmers, in the large field for organics, we use a tool called a rotary hoe. The closest thing to that available for a gardener is a tool called a weed weasel. And what it is a long handle with maybe a half a dozen little star wheels down on the end that kind of look like a set of spurs for cowboy boots. And they set these at an angle so that one intermeshes in with the other, so when you push them across the soil, it kind of does a sideways movement, and it causes the soil to be dug up a little bit. I got one of these this spring, and I don't know if it's actually the brand that was called a Weed Weasel or if it was a aftermarket or a copy model. I was not very impressed with it. It was kind of a cheap plastic thing, and I wasn't very satisfied with it. And so what I'm going to do is take all the wheels off and make a U-shaped end down there about maybe 6 inches wide, so that I'll take a bolt and put through all of those little star wheels, and I'm going to put them all vertical side by side, so they're maybe 3/4 inch or 1 inch apart, and I'll put some little washers in between it. Now they won't get stuck running against each other, and I'll be able to push that up and down over the row and put a little down pressure on it, and it will stick those tines into the soil that just gently stirs the surface of the soil. For example, sweet corn, you're probably going to plant about an inch and a half deep, so you can go over the top inch of that soil for a while and keep it stirred up so that any weed seeds that are germinating in that top quarter, half inch that are going to start to come up will be killed by that little star wheel apparatus stirring the soil. The other thing that you can use, I purchased a a rake, just like a rake that you would use to rake up leaves on the lawn, and it was made out of wires about the thickness of a coat hanger wire, and these tines were about 20 inches long, and uniquely, this one had a little slide deal on it that all of the tines went through this plastic, and you could move this plastic forward and backward. And so as you moved it forward, it brought the tines together, just like you bring your fingers together. And when you pulled it back, it spread all the tines apart, just like if you open your hand and spread your fingers apart. So you could either have the tines close or far apart as you desired. And this is very similar to a large machine that we use in a 30-foot wide machine called a tine weeder. And so we use a combination of a rotary hoe and a tine weeder. The rotary hoe will dig a little bit deeper and dig up the dirt and destroy those weeds, and it doesn't go in so far that it digs the corn out. Even if you push down with these little rotary hoe wheels on your handheld weed weasel star wheel thing, it will not dig the seed out. It may go down, it may move it a little bit sideways one or the other. It may even puncture it. And after it's germinated, that doesn't matter either. When we're hoeing with a large machine, we expect that maybe we're going to take out 1-2% of the seeds. So if we had 30,000 seeds planted, we expect to maybe lose 500 or 1,000 seeds, which doesn't affect the end result. And so if you happen to kill one of your sweet corn seeds, it really isn't that critical. But if you don't put a lot of down pressure, you won't have any problem with that. The rake can be used like the tine weeder, and we use the two in combination. Sometimes we use a rotary hoe on the big machine or your little star wheel handheld to stir the soil just deep enough, and then you can use the rake to lightly move the soil on the surface just to destroy those weeds. And in weed control, the easiest way to kill all the weeds in the garden is to never let them get started. So after you plant your crop, go out there after the first couple of days and look at the ground and keep looking until you find one little weed leaf, maybe only a 16th of an inch in diameter, that stuck his head out of the ground. That's the time to use the little star wheel and stir up the soil, and you'll kill that little weed. You'll also disrupt the roots of the other weeds that are starting to come up, but they haven't turned into a leaf, but they're so small you don't even really see them. But when you move the soil and dry the soil out a little bit, those little weeds just simply die because they can't get any water, and they just dry up and shrivel up in the sun or the warmth there. The tine weeder also covers the dirt. The rake will move dirt. So if you don't dig that little 16th inch of a diameter leaf and perhaps a 16th of an inch or an 1/8 of an inch tall weed, if you don't dig it out, simply using that rake and dragging it across the garden will move a little bit of soil over that little small weed, and once you place a little particle of soil on top of it, the weed is done. The power that a seed has to emerge from the soil is all in the emerging stem. And once it comes out of the ground, it loses that force to push up through the dirt. And so when you cover it up with the dirt, the little weed is done. Let's see. You also can use your rototiller. If you have a power tiller, you can use that in between the rows. And if you leave a stick at the end of each row, and for gardening, I don't advocate a real narrow row system like I'm advocating for the farmers with the crops. You want to have a row width wide enough that you can put your rototiller down through it, and you also need that row width that's comfortable for you to walk in there with a picking basket or a bucket to harvest your crop. And one other thing you can do with this little rake is that whichever way you have the rows planted, the long way, if they're planted north and south, one time you might come out there when you see those first little weeds on the third day after you planted, and you might just cover over the garden with the rake, just simply dragging it back and forth and stirring the soil just enough to see that you've broken that dry soil and brought up a little moisture. And then maybe 2 days later, there'll be some more weeds coming out. So you go out there and do it the other way. Do it east and west. And perhaps a third time, you might do it northeast, southeast. This is exactly what we do with the large tractor machines, is we go a different direction every time because we move the soil in different directions. And I would say you can go out there once every couple, 3 days, but if you want to really guarantee to get all those little weeds, simply do a light raking and do it every single day. It's not possible for any of those little weeds to come up. And then if you have those sticks from one end to the other, and or perhaps a string laid out where the row is actually planted, you can stir the soil right up close to the string without being afraid that you're getting down in and hurting your crop. And the other thing that we do, and I do this as a farmer, when I start rotary hoeing to see how low to set the hoe or how much spring pressure to put on it, I get out and I dig up with your finger or a screwdriver. You hunt around till you find the seed and you see what it looks like if you went down and dug any of it out. With the big machinery, we can sometimes, if we're doing if we're doing it too aggressively, we'll see seeds dug out and thrown out on top of the ground. You're not going to experience that with gardening, and for the most part, your hand tools will not likely dig out those larger seeds like peas, beans, and sweet corn. You could damage smaller things like carrots or radish. So you would need to be careful there and follow your string and only work the dirt up as close as you can to each side without actually digging that out. You'll have very little work in weeding if you prepare your soil properly in the fall and the spring. And if you follow the practice of doing that little bit of light surface tillage with those hand tools prior to your garden vegetables coming up. One thing on a crop like string beans, green string beans, are very similar. They're in the same family as soybeans that farmers grow. And when they come up through the soil, they don't push straight up. They push up, if you've seen them before and have gardens, you know that they push up in kind of a U-shaped hump. And after they emerge from the ground, then the leaf turns around and stands up. So one thing you do not want to do is touch those with any of your hand tillage tools when they're in what we call the hook stage. And the hook stage is there when the crop is still under the surface of the soil. So on a crop like soy, like beans, you want to dig with a little screwdriver and see when those crops start to come up and have that hook stage, you want to make sure that you aren't running your little tine wheel weeder or the rake over the top of them and breaking those off. Because if you break them off, that plant is done and it will not grow. That pretty much concludes what I have to say about the garden preparation for the present. And we can see if we get some questions on things that you want to know. We'd appreciate some kind of feedback on that, and we will come up with the answers.
Okay, that sounds good. Sounds very good. Okay, well, we'll take a break here because we're at the bottom of the hour, and hopefully Miss Cookie will feel up to doing a proclamation for us when we come back. Would that be awesome, Miss Cookie? Would that be okay? Are you feeling up to it?
That would be fine. There was only one thing I wanted to mention while Kurt was on the phone. When I did my first organic gardening and tilled my garden in the fall like you were supposed to, one thing that came up for us was a lot of rocks. And we ended up having to dig out all these rocks and put them alongside the garden and actually make almost like a fence around the garden. And I know some areas might not have a lot of rocks, but where we lived in Wisconsin, we were loaded with great big huge rocks. And what was so cute is in the spring when we went to re-till the garden, my children came out again to help pick up the rocks and put them on the outside of the garden and where the fence was. And one of the kids go, I don't think this is funny. Who is the neighbor that's coming over here and putting rocks in our garden again? We got them all out in the fall, and look at it. It's just loaded again. And he didn't understand that the rocks come from the surface of the ground, from the center of the earth, and because you tilled the garden and loosened it up, they decide to surface. But over the years, we got enough rocks to build a field stone fireplace, which was a real benefit. But I just thought I'd mention it, Kurt, that a lot of people might end up with a lot of rocks.
Probably only if they live in the glaciated area. And I had one college buddy who lives up in central Wisconsin, north of Marshfield, and he talked about how many wagon loads of rocks he took off the acre. And 5 years ago, when I was over in Norway, I cleared about a 10-acre field of rocks, and it took me 3 weeks picking up rocks. I had a tractor with a digger on it, and I dug every 12 inches side by side and about 12 inches deep. I hauled literally a few semi-loads of rocks off that field. Some of them were so big I had to have the loader to, you know, lift them on the front end. Most of them I had a carry cart on the back, and I just set it down, rolled the rocks in, went to the next one. And, you know, I thought about my great-grandfather from Norway many years ago, and I thought, yep, he had to do the same labor, and I actually enjoyed taking the rocks off because I was experiencing what my great-grandfather did years and years before. But most people aren't going to have too much of a problem with rocks. If there's no evidence of rocks around your house yard, chances are you're not going to find many in the garden. You may find one or two, but a lot of times homes are built on, you know, good soil. People don't want to build a house on a rock pile. And only if we live in those areas, like, and I know you live in the northern Wisconsin, we have that glaciated area where they're carried in.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, very good. We'll be back after this short commercial break. Valerie Ann is back with the Truth Exposition. She returns tonight. Yay!
Join me, Valerie Ann, on the Truth Exposition Show at Freedomizer Radio in exposing the truth about FEMA camps, drone surveillance, martial law, the New World Order, our threatened freedoms and civil liberties, and for weekly news and current events. Mainstream media continues with its lies and deceit to fulfill the agenda of the New World Order. So please join me in exposing the truth, along with the lies and the deceptions that are being fed to the American people. The people of the United States have a voice, and your voice will be heard through Freedomizer Radio.
How's it going, Freedomizers? This is Ferdinand. Join me on the No Bull Zone every Monday night from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We talk about everything from local to national issues, how to be free, and even throw in some health talks. Call in to chat or suggest a topic. That's the No Bull Zone every Monday evening from 8 to 9 p.m. East Coast Time, only on Freedomizer Radio.
Hi, this is the Rose Colombo, right here on the Justice Club at Freedomizer Radio, where freedom is free and the truth is allowed. On the front line for 25 years, protecting your civil rights, constitutional rights, and fighting back against legal abuse.
Join Rose Colombo every Monday and Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. That's the Justice Club with Rose Colombo, only on Freedomizer Radio.
Rose has added another show, and so she's here on Fridays at 11 o'clock in the morning Pacific Standard Time as well. And today we are here with Kurt John Forty, and he's talking about Prophet Organics. We've been talking about how to prepare your garden for the winter. Those of you who have no dirt, little dirt, apartment dirt, no fear. There's always container gardening, and we just don't want to leave anybody out. Don't be discouraged. Even with me moving every 3 weeks, and I have no dirt. In the wintertime, last winter, I had fresh organic lettuce all winter and only had to bring in my plants 5 nights the whole winter to keep them from freezing. So, and I'm in Southern California. Okay, I gotcha. But, you know, there are options out there for everyone, and we don't have to be, we don't have to have a tractor. Isn't that right, Kurt?
That is correct.
We're just so happy to have you here and share your personal experience with farming and gardening, et cetera. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you.
I want to check in with Howard, and he's been patiently waiting out there. Howard, do you have any other questions for Kurt?
Well, may I say it, I'm going to use microbes to knock out the Roundup and try and get the soil back, get the casings of the earthworms, which they say will be in the soil for a long time, try and get the poison out of the soil. By the way, that BT corn kills the insects by breaking open the stomach, and I just wonder if that GMO corn that we eat have the same difficulty with hurting people's stomach. So I yield.
That comment that you made about the cattle in South Dakota, when I saw that they were all dying in this storm, I thought, you know, it's not 30 below zero out there. It's just a snowstorm. Cattle can live by licking the snow for water. And quite frankly, I was shocked when they were showing on TV that there was so many cattle that died. Now, I don't know the exact extent of the storm. As a farmer, I was just simply shocked that they said there was so many cattle that died, and it really raised a question in my mind when you brought out about the swelling of the nose or the eyes or mouth or something. That's a little bit scary.
I may not be accurate, but I think they call it EHS, but anyhow, there's a lot of stuff on the Internet right now.
EHS.
Yes, yeah, EHS. That might not be accurate, but it's close.
Edward Harry Samuel.
Yep.
Okay. One other thing that you might check out on this glyphosate or the Roundup residue is, I think I mentioned it before, about I think the farm is FHR Farms in Stuartville, Minnesota. They are a conventional farmer, but they promote non-GMO crops. They're totally against the GMOs. And I believe I mentioned before that they had tested some weeds from a field that hadn't had any Roundup on it for like 6 years, and they still found traces of the glyphosate in it. And that really changed my thoughts on this Roundup and how important it is that we steer away from it.
Yeah, it takes 20 years to eradicate it.
Well, whatever's there, we're just going to have to deal with it. The best thing we can do is just stop adding more to it.
Yeah, you ever heard of this gal in California? I think her name is Rachel Peterson or something like that. She's done a lot of work against Roundup Monsanto.
No, I have not ever heard that name. I was talking to, I mentioned earlier I had been to the coffee shop this morning, and the reason I stuck there so long, sat down and talked to a man who moved into this area from down Illinois, and he has a farm here, but he's with a machinery company. He owns a machinery company, and they make a product to add to some farm machinery, so it's kind of a specialized piece of machinery. And he said that he used to work for one of the large tractor companies, and he said that years ago, those large tractor companies were focused on the farmers, their customers. They were privately held companies, and they focused on doing what was good for their customers because that was good for their company. Now, he said, they've been sold out. They're publicly traded on the stock exchange,
And he said now the focus that he got when he was in there was that they were focused on pleasing the shareholders. So it was all about profit. And he said, you know, he took this take on Monsanto, and I'm not defending Monsanto. I'm only relaying his perspective. He said, it's not the people at Monsanto. He said, Monsanto is a publicly owned company. This is what I was told. I don't even know this for fact myself. I don't follow it. But assuming that everything he told me was true, Monsanto being a public company and having shareholders, they are totally focused on making a profit and dividends for their shareholders because that guarantees that they keep their jobs. The CEO and all the management people are not going to keep their jobs if they don't make a profit. So from the top down, the whole management level is profit for the company. It's not about what's good for the farmer. It's not about what's good for the environment. It was like I told this the last time I spoke, that at the organic conference over three different years, the first year they were all up in arms about BT corn. I didn't say anything because I had got dosed with an insecticide, and I didn't know anything about it, but I thought, well, what's wrong if we don't have to use insecticide? And then they came out with the Roundup, and I thought, well, they say it's the safest one there is, and what's wrong if they don't have to use all the other worse, or seem they were saying worse herbicides? But it wasn't until the next year when they came out with seed terminator technology. You could no longer save your soybeans and plant them over again because they wouldn't grow. It wasn't just illegal to plant them. They wouldn't grow. What if you couldn't save your garden seeds? What if they genetically engineered your beans and your peas that you buy in a little package, but when you don't pick all of your crop at the end of the year, you can pick out some of those seeds, let them drop naturally on the plant, then take them in and dry them and save them, and you don't have to buy seeds for the next year. But what if you couldn't plant them because they were sterile? They wouldn't grow. And you were forced to buy the seeds from a company, and they could charge you whatever they wanted for the seed, or else you're not going to have any food to eat. I've acquired a much more serious perspective of promoting the non-GMO and holding the value to ourselves and not allowing any corporation to take control of our seed supply and our food supply.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, on that note, I'm going to give you guys some really, 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 really good news. This is an October 10th press release from Mexico City announcing the ban of genetically engineered corn in Mexico. According to the group that issued the press release, a federal judge has ordered Mexico's equivalent of the EPA, it's a big long name, to immediately suspend all activities involving the plant of transgenic corn in the country and end the granting of permission for experimental and pilot commercial planting. This is an unprecedented ban and was granted by the 12th Federal District Court for Civil Matters of Mexico City. And the reason for this decision, the risk of imminent harm to the environment. I am so excited.
On that very thought, the same man that I was talking to this morning also informed me, and I had not heard this before, that Monsanto has engineered a Roundup-ready sweet corn, and he said that all the sweet corn that will soon be available in the supermarkets will be Roundup-ready, and nobody will even know that. Then I talked to another gentleman from out of state today, and he was. I told him about it. He's an organic farmer, and he said, well, his nephew grows sweet corn. He's a conventional farmer, and he grows sweet corn. And this year, he said he was pretty sure that he planted Roundup Ready sweet corn because he was so proud that he had a weed-free sweet corn field and didn't have to go and dig the sweet corn out of a weed patch. And so from a farmer perspective, this young man thought that was great from his grower standpoint. So all we have to do
is to show them how to have a weed-free field, and applying these same principles, we come right back to our gardens. We can have perfect weed-free gardens that we can be proud of, and they're prosperous for us, and hopefully we'll have enough vegetables out of them that you'll be giving them away to your neighbors.
Yes, excellent, excellent. Cookie, do you have a proclamation for us, my dear?
Yes, I sure do. It's called Reclaiming Dominion. There are beings who have claimed ownership of property at the expense of other people, and this property is more than a few square feet or even a few acres. They have extended their claim to encompass the planet, even the universe. The universe of Earth belongs to all life forms, and no one can take it from you what is yours unless you allow them. So no one can keep what belongs to you unless you allow them. So this proclamation is called Reclaiming Dominion. From the divine love within my being, I call forth those who have extended their power over the universe of the earth to stand before me as I stand before you in love. I ask you to forgive and honor me. I forgive and honor you. I thank you for the lessons we have shared. I embrace all bonds between us in unconditional love. As a representative of humanity, I proclaim dominion over the universe of the earth as far as those energies extend. I reclaim sovereignty and my ability to co-create with all elemental consciousness within creation, according to my heart's desire, and so it is. Take a deep breath, exhale, and clap your hands. Amen.
Amen. Very exciting. So, Kurt, what are your plans for this next week? Do you have any tidbits you can share with the audience about what your plans are for spreading the word this week?
Yes. I spoke with the gentleman that I farm with for the last years and laid out some of the projects that we're doing here and asked him to what extent he wanted to be involved in all of that and told him what we're doing. I've been telling a few people about the Freedomizer Radio and to listen and everything. And during this next week, my primary focus is to work with the crops that I have up there because I need to secure as much data. I need to go out and count the number of plants per acre in different parts of the field to determine what we have for a population stand. And so I'm going to open up a lot of ears. They're at maturity now, so I can go ahead and open those ears up and count those kernels like I told you I just did. And I want to do it on as many places in the farm just to get a feel for what we can anticipate coming out of the entire field as an average for the farm. And while the end result or the bottom line is how many bushels of corn, how many semi-loads of corn do we get off it, and how many dollars did the owner get compared to the dollars that he's invested into equipment, seed, and expenses in growing the crop, he needs to make a profit. We're excited that it looks like we're going to make a profit and a good profit for the first year. We're going to search through the field to find the best areas and the least productive areas of the field. The fields, for the most part, are looking pretty even. We're quite satisfied with it in spite of the challenges we had this spring. And what I'm actually looking for is the excitement that even if I said that we averaged 100 bushels per acre and we had some 50 bushel corn and 75 and some 125 or whatever, but I'm looking for that spot that maybe we had 200 bushels per acre. What was right in that spot, population density or the area of the field? And the important and the exciting thing from our experimentation point of view is if we have a 30-foot by 30-foot square chunk of land that yielded
200 bushels to the acre, for example, twice as much as the rest of the farm, then the potential is there. We can, what do we need to do to the rest of the farm to bring it all up to this level next year? And so that's what the total focus on it here is, to see that we can replicate this. I mentioned this to the man today, and I said, you know, we have good success this year. We're very, very satisfied with what we've achieved this year. And I said, the most significant thing is when we do it again next year. And he goes, absolutely. That was what he was looking for, that would give him the comfort that he would want to dive in and go along with the program, is when he saw some kind of an assurance that, well, this wasn't just one little experiment that happened to work out. We can replicate our success. That's the reason that I have a purpose in searching for so many farmers as I can possibly find and as we can possibly coordinate to make this happen, that we have, we'll just say, 35 farms that participate in this. It's almost like having 35 years of experience. If I only did this project on one little farm, and it turned out fantastic, and we do it again next year, and it turns out fantastic, farmers are of the nature that, well, I'm going to wait another couple of years and see if it still works out. So now we're 5 years down the road before they say, wow, we need to do that, or we can do that. In 5 years, if the GMO approach was left in place, we may be going to a point where it'd be difficult or more difficult to come back. We're at the edge right now that we have prices in the corn industry have plummeted. There's going to be a lot of farmers that are going to be in the negative. They not are, if they don't have yield, they may not generate enough money to pay their rents and their bank loans off. When that happens, they're looking for an answer. In the last couple of years, it would have been a challenge to try to excite anybody about organics because they were making so much money, they didn't care. But now they're down to the wire, and yeah, a farmer can lose money 1 year, but he can't continue to lose. So they're going to be listening this next year. And one thing that we're making happen this next week is I've had a talk from a major newspaper who is going to try to coordinate coming out and doing an interview on the farm. So we may have an opportunity to be featured on a page in a statewide newspaper, which will get the word out there to a lot of farmers.
Excellent. 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 Well, Kurt, you know, I really want to thank you for being here and sharing your experience with everyone. Please go and check out Kurt's website, profitorganics.com. Complete and full access to this website is $25. For life, you get all of Kurt's knowledge. We're going to put those. Have you ever seen those little brain, those commercials or cartoons where they put the little things on people's heads and suck the knowledge out of their brain? That's what we're going to do with Kurt here. We're going to take all the knowledge that we can from him and apply it where it needs to be applied in the farming industry, the basis of where all of our food comes from. And please, 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 please support your local farmers. And when farmers are doing the right thing and they're working hard to bring you good food, then we really want to encourage that. And we're just so happy to have you here to share all this great information. And perhaps next time when you come back, we'd like to hear from you about your trip to Norway.
Okay, and I appreciate that. And I guess I'd like to add that I wouldn't want you to remove my information, but you can copy it. And that's what the website is actually all about, is teaching farmers to simply copy what we know to be successful. And so that's what we're selling on there, is the information, is how to copy what we're doing. I was in and talked with a computer programmer 2 days ago, And we are in the process of doing some change there to download some pictures and to add some things to it. As of yet, we do not have the garden tab or the garden page up, and so we are going to create that. We're going to load on some pictures. The greenhouse that I'm building, I've decided I'm going to extend it maybe another 10 feet, and there's some bare ground out there with some weeds on it. So I decided that I'm going to plant some garden seeds here on Monday, and I'm going to use the tools that I was talking about, and I'm going to take some pictures of that and do part of it and show what it looks like so that I can post those pictures on the website, and you'll get a feel for what to do next spring. And so what I'm going to primarily do is start that tillage, and I'll give you a little bit of an idea how to do this. But whether you, there's no wrong way to do it. Any kind of tillage you can do is better than no tillage. So whatever you want to do for a garden, till up a good place, dig it up, any which way you can, just get it done. And I guess the last statement I'd like to make, in general, we need to focus on helping our organic farmers to make a profit while being good stewards. In this way, doing this, we will draw more of the conventional farmers our way. You'll notice I said draw them. We don't force them to join us. We show them why they want to be with us. I believe when we do this properly and approach this from a point of profit and a point of ethics and show that it's good for their families and it's good for their farms to do this, that all the rest of the advantages are just frosting on the cake. And I believe that in the next 2 to 5 years, we will see a massive shift to profitable organic farming, and that will increase the seed industry's necessity of production of non-GMO crops. When we have a massive amount of conventional farmers switch right over to organic farming, because next year our plan is to take commercial, chemical farmers, if you will, and plant the fields, and I've discussed with some of those farmers that we're going to plant long test rows fields with all these different corns, and we're going to take a tillage machine after it's planted, we're going to go crosswise in the middle of the rows and cut the field in half. And then either the front half or the back half, whichever the farmer wants to take, he can take one and fertilize it, spray it, and do whatever, because there's sprays out there that they can use on the non-GMO crops. So we're going to use the type of corns that we're using in the organic industry to find out which one of those are going to perform the best. And in the same row, on the other end of the row, we're going to have experimentation that shows this is the best that this good or this chemical farmer can do with that crop. And we're going to take the other end of the field, rotary hoe it, fertilize it with a organic fertilizer, so we have what the organic industry calls first-year transition. And we're going to show them that they don't have to take a drop in yield. They're still going to get good bushel yield and sell it on the conventional market and still make a profit in their transition process. And then the second year, likewise. And then by the third year, they're able to sell a certified organic crop, get those same good yields, and get a higher price and increase their net profit dramatically. When we do this, the GMOs will simply diminish the need for them, and they will eventually disappear because no one wants to plant them. No one has to make them go away. We simply promote the other side of agriculture, the organic side of agriculture, and the GMOs will go away because there's no profit in them because there's no one that wants to plant them.
Right. So that's where we're going. Food manufacturers, because of consumer demand, are going to be requesting non-GMO corn. If you are planting GMO corn, you're in the past already because the future is organic. So I want to thank everyone for being here. Thank you to Kurt. Thank you, Cookie. Thank you, Howard. God love you all, and we'll be back on Monday at 10 o'clock in the morning with more updates on what's going on in the world in GMOs and food safety, and updates on the march against Monsanto. So God bless everyone. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.